This episode is brought to you by Foster Sundry, a specialty grocery located in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Have you ever wanted to open a restaurant, launch your own food brand, or dive into the ever-changing world of food media? Well, buckle up. Join us for Aspiration to Action, a special live podcast on Monday, June 3rd at Haven's Kitchen in Manhattan. Zara Tangora and Bretton Scott, hosts of Life's a Banquet, will lead us through tales of the good, the bad, and the transformative. Featuring food world innovators and HRN hosts, Dana Cowan, host of Speaking Broadly, Eli Sussman, host of The Line, along with his brother Max, and Allison Kane, host of In the Sauce, in conversation with Jenny Britton Bauer. Light refreshments will be provided by Paris Gourmet, Wolfer Estate Vineyard, and Tahani. Get your tickets before they sell out by going to heritageradionetwork.org/action.
Hey gang, if you're in the Ohio area, I will be at the Culinary Vegetable Institute at the renowned Chef's Garden on Saturday, June 22nd. Legendary chefs David Waltuck and Claudia Fleming will be joining the Institute chef Jamie Simpson to create a 1980s-themed dinner based on my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. There will be a talk. There will be a cocktail reception. To learn more or purchase tickets, visit culinaryvegetableinstitute.com, click on the reserve link, and look for the event titled Lecture Series, Totally 80s, with Andrew Friedman. Hope to see you there.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stone.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
For me, it wasn't a choice. That's what I needed to do. And I think that is what draws you in the kitchen. And actually what keeps you in a kitchen. I mean, you can't work in a kitchen and go through everything, you know, that a kitchen goes through and not love what you're doing. I mean, I'm not saying it's perfect and it's always romantic. That's not for sure. But there are some days that are really tough and you're like kind of in the trenches with the rest of the cooks and you have to make it happen and you're like, oh my gosh, why am I doing this? But you know, it's that thing that's in your core that makes you want to be there.
That is Della Gossett, pastry chef of Spago Restaurant, one of several chefs and industry figures we spoke to at the LA Chef Conference in Santa Monica a few weeks ago, our guests for this special report of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. I'm back with Caitlin Friedman. Hello, Caitlin.
Hi, Andrew.
How are you?
I'm great.
We're not really great.
Well,
it's been a trying week.
It's been a hard week, but we're okay.
Yeah, I traveled. I was home for a few days. Then you traveled.
Yeah, on Memorial Day.
On Memorial Day, and you're already back.
I know. I'm in this haze.
You're in a haze. Yeah. It's crazy. I'm getting ready to leave again in a week and a half. But Caitlin, we're going to keep all this short. You and I have somewhere to be. Mm-hmm. The show is late this week. Mm-hmm. I want to say that it's because of the Memorial Day holiday. In fact, I did say that on Instagram the other day. But the truth is, I've just, like, all my circuits blew out. Like, I had too many. The holiday came and went, and I had 5 interviews to edit for this special. And you were out of town, and Tuesday morning, it was like everyone who had been checked out for like 4 or 5 days for the holiday weekend wanted a piece of me, and it just like blew my circuits. It was all I could do to like tread water, to be honest.
I think it happens.
Anyway, Jeet Paul, our engineer, is going to get this episode up on Thursday or Friday. I'm going to be transmitting it to the studio Thursday morning, right after we do this intro. And anyway, I went to the LA Chef Conference. It was the second annual LA Chef Conference. It is part of the Los Angeles Times Food Bowl. It's orchestrated by my new buddy, newish buddy, Brad Metzger. You met Brad.
I met him in Los Angeles.
Yeah, you and I were in Santa Monica for a big birthday of yours a year ago last week. And we were just walking around, and I had never met him at that point.
Right.
And he recognized us from, like, our Instagram pictures and accosted us. Just
no,
kidding,
you don't,
Brad.
Do you not remember?
What?
He came up to me and said, "Good morning, Mrs. Tokeland."
And that's right. Totally, which is my blog name.
Out.
Right.
I was like, who are you?
Yes.
Why are you calling me Mrs. Stokeland?
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, Brad and his team of Brad Metzger Restaurant Solutions. He has a hospitality recruiting firm or company or agent. I don't know the noun he likes. Brad's also a alumnus of the restaurant industry. He, you know, worked in restaurants since age 15, basically, and then shifted over and started doing this very successfully. And now he puts on this event, which is a ton of work. I mean, he and his team of elves, you know, his regular team, this gets added on to like what they do. They're all hospitality veterans, so they're kind of built for it. But it was still an enormous undertaking. It was in three different venues in Santa Monica, ArcLight Theaters and the Gourmandise Cooking School, and they had one other space. There were several theaters in the ArcLight Cinema that they were using, and then not quite next door, but almost next door on the second level of this place was the Gourmandise Cooking School, where they had chef demos going on. So there were multiple things going on all the time. It was crazy. The lineup was amazing. I did an interview with Brad the day before the conference started, just minutes before the welcome reception. And then, I snagged a bunch of interviews at the conference. The last interview was supposed to be with Brooke Williamson, and her panel ran late. My panel ran late. Then I did a book signing. It had been a very long day, and she came out of her panel. We looked at each other, and I was like, rain check. And we ended up meeting at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
Oh.
Yeah. So that interview was not on site.
There.
I do love the market.
Yeah.
Anyway, Caitlin, we're going to keep this a little short, but you're just back. Your trip that we just mentioned was actually to and from L.A.
I love it there.
Yeah. You were torturing me with pictures of your feet in the rooftop pool of your hotel.
Okay, but I need to explain. I was actually working. It was just a perfect place to work.
Yes, you were reading things in advance of meetings.
Yes.
Yes, with your feet in a pool at the roof on the rooftop of the London Hotel.
75-degree sunny weather.
Yes. That's why we've all come around on Los Angeles.
I know. It is a quality of life upgrade, I have to say.
Do you know what I realized recently? I get texts and messages and stuff from listeners to the show, many of whom have become friends of mine because of the show. Brad Metzger's one. My pal Jody Liano at the San Francisco Cooking School is another. And I had this realization the other day. I hear from people in New York who listen to the show that they listen as like on their subway commute to work, you know, things like that. But my California listeners, the messages I get are, I was out running, you know, this morning in Santa Monica listening to the show, or I was out for my morning walk with my dog listening to the show.
Oh, okay. But you're not hearing from the people that are sitting in traffic listening to your show.
Oh, no. Once in a while, they say, you know, this really helps my commute.
Oh, okay.
But they're still sitting in an air-conditioned car. It's sunny.
It's sunny.
All these, every single one of the interviews, with the exception of Brad, which we did in my hotel room because it was the only quiet place we could find at the hotel, all these interviews are outside.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear the sunshine in the interviews. Yeah. I mean, I honestly was listening back to them. You can hear it. You can hear the breeze. You know, you can feel the climate. I really believe that. It's such a factor in how everybody out there lives their lives, and not everybody. There's unhealthy people everywhere, but how so many of these people, like, you know, that farmer's market, even, you know, it's. I talked to Della Gossett about this in our interview. It is a year-round market.
Yeah.
You know. Anyway, let's get to it. First interview is with Brad himself. Conducted again in my room. If people follow social media, then you already will know, or follow me on social media, that I was presented with something very flattering late in the interview. It was a total surprise. I'm still a bit chuffed, as my British friends would say, about it. But Brad, you know, created this hospitality recruitment company back in the aughts and has done very well with it. He's got quite a sizable team now. I met several of them at this event. And we talk about the LA Chef Conference and how it started. We talk about some industry issues. We talk about the art and craft of recruiting. I briefly got to meet his wife, Linda, there. She doesn't say much in the interview, but she was present and does talk a little bit. And I think that's all I need to say about it. What do you think?
I think that's great.
You always say you think it's great.
Well, what am I going to say? That's terrible.
I would do a redo on the intro. Anyway, I think it sounds fine, too. Okay, so with that, here's my first interview of this. Again, this is a long episode, guys, but I hope you all like these and you just listen to them maybe one at a time. Most of these interviews, I don't think any of them clock in at over 30 minutes. So hopefully it's a fun anthology for you all. Probably the last one for a while. I'm not going to be at any conferences for a while. Anyway, here you go. My interview with Brad Metzger, conducted in my hotel room at the Viceroy Santa Monica a few weeks ago. We are in my hotel room overlooking the ocean for the, well, this is technically the second, do we say annual?
Annual.
LA Chef Conference. This year it went up a couple of notches because you became part of the LA Times Food Bowl, which for people who don't know is what? Were
you last? It was last year too.
Oh, last year too? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So how did it go so big so fast?
Last year went so well.
Yeah.
And the response was so amazing. And basically, the opportunity allowed us to move it from IPIC over to Gourmandise Cooking School.
Right.
And Arclight.
Yeah. Two
cinemas.
Venues. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
So.
And everybody wanted in because they heard good things. That's how these things
correct.
Grow. Yeah.
This is the third year of the LA Times Food Bowl.
Yeah.
The first year we did a one session. Seminar, Labor Crisis Summit.
I see.
That was 3 years ago.
Okay.
2 years ago, we did LA Chef Conference.
You mean last year?
Yeah, last year.
Yep.
LA Chef Conference over at IPIC with Sherry Yard. We had three sessions.
Yeah.
And now, here, this year, 13 sessions.
Yeah.
A four-part restaurant workshop.
Yep.
Eight cooking demos.
Yep.
Six chefs doing lunch. Much bigger.
So as we sit here, all this is about to go down. When this airs, it will have all just gone down. I hope you'll, I don't know, sight unseen. I'm taking it on faith that I'm going to say from the future, I hope you'll do it again.
Thank you.
I know it was a lot of work.
It's a lot of work
to put on
a conference like this.
I think with the exception of the hotel confirmation, I only ever heard from you or one other person in your organization.
Maybe Erica,
yes.
Sarah. You know, I'll tell you something, though. Putting this event on has been so enlightening. It's given me an incredible appreciation, again, for the industry and the people in the industry.
Yeah.
Because so many people came together to make this happen. You know, I own a hospitality recruiting firm. We're not a event production company. So between my wife, Linda, my
who's
staff,
sitting here.
Linda's here.
Yes.
Hi, everybody.
Between Linda, my whole team at BMRS, and the incredible friends in the industry and our sponsors, they really, really came through. It's been amazing to see people support this event. Even like yourself, you put me in touch with potential sponsors that worked out.
Yes.
And it's been enlightening.
Well, this is why I like to, I guess to my detriment, because it doesn't really give me a home, but I more identify with people who I'm friends with who are in the hospitality business than they do people who write for a living.
Mm-hmm.
I think other writers and some editors probably have an issue with that. Others think it gives me great access, but it is what draws me to your old industry, the one that you're on the tangent of now and the one that I observe now, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty, Do people who work for you tend to come out of hospitality?
Yes, all of us. Basically all of us.
Okay, so this is why you guys can put a conference on, because, you know, that's the can-do business.
Right, but even in 16 years of having my company, we've never had anyone in the recruiting come from a recruiting background.
As opposed to hospitality.
They've all come from hospitality. Or, for example, I have two young ladies right now, Tatum and Sadie, that are right out of college.
Okay.
And I've had other employees come right out of school or even have their first job be with us.
Yeah.
And I've just found that with the right training and the right culture, it's really about personality and ethics and willingness to learn and absorb and just being super sharp. And we tend to teach them our ways of doing things, especially with regard to the ethics of recruiting. And it just has worked.
What are the ethics of recruiting?
Oh, boy.
in a fraction of the time you have.
But what are
the ethics? Because I don't even know how many people out there. I don't want to say whom. There's someone else in your business, and their name came up recently in a conversation, and someone said, "Well, you know, they only can work for the really big companies because those are the only ones who can afford to pay, you know, the whatever you, I guess, commission or finder's fee. I don't know what you call it.
Fee.
But
yeah.
How does, for people? I mean, I would say probably the majority of people out there don't use a firm like yours. So how does it work? I mean, well, in broad strokes, without.
I mean,
specifics.
Let's talk about the ethics first.
Sure.
Okay? The ethics are super, super important. You have ethics that you have to treat candidates with and ethics you have to treat clients with. And they're different. For example, with candidates, we have an obligation to communicate with them in a timely way. All right. Let's say a candidate goes on an interview, right?
Yeah.
We need to tell them, is there a next step? Is there not a next step within a reasonable time? If they're not going to be hired, we don't just blow them off. We have respect for them and we communicate with them because mm-hmm. you know what? It's not about this one position. It's about a relationship and having a reputation in the industry and being respectful of that person as a human being.
Let's say you have a client, a repeat client, who you, and I just want to say to everyone out there, this is not based on Brad having told me a story or something. This is a hypothetical I have wondered about. I wonder about this when I pair up friends of mine with projects, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you know the client, meaning the employer, to be a pain in the ass, to be an unreasonable person. Now, in the hospitality business, there are a lot of dysfunctional relationships.
Absolutely.
It could be that you could say that to a certain chef and they would go, they would know what you meant. And you could say, I think they need someone like you who's going to push back, right? It could, is that part of the ethics? Would you feel the need to, in a constructive way, reveal something like that?
Yes. We are a representative of the client, meaning the restaurant who's looking for the staff member.
Yes.
So, first of all, to take your example, if they were that bad, we wouldn't be working with them in the first place.
Okay. Right. So if you were talking to a potential employee, let's generously call the kind of thing I'm describing a foible, okay, about the employer, right? You might say this person's a little whatever. It doesn't even need to be that harsh, right? They're
difficult.
A little artsy, or even they're a little spontaneous.
You may have
three specials thrown at you when this person walks in the door at 5 p.m.,
yeah.
You know, you down for that, right? You're not really talking smack about the employer. That, to me, would be to facilitate a good match.
Correct.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's our job to understand the client and to represent that client to the candidate.
Yes.
At the end of the day, if we misrepresent the client to the candidate gets the job and they get into a situation where they're not a good fit for or they're not expecting something and they leave, it's not good for us, for either party.
Yeah. You know? Okay. So let's go back a little bit. You used to work in restaurants for how long? Starting at what age?
Well, one of my first real job was as a bread baker and prep cook at Spago on Sunset when I was about 17 years old.
Okay.
Even before that, I was working at humongous Hollywood premieres as a catering busboy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I wasn't even driving.
What kind of premieres? Like, can you,
oh, my gosh.
Like, what would be Hollywood, a big movie that you...
Big movie. I don't remember which movie, but there were, like, parking lots in Hollywood where they would, you know, have tents and have, like, 2,000 people.
Yeah,
this was the heyday.
And you would work those?
I would work those. I would have a little bow tie.
Was that fun or was it hell?
Like, it was amazing.
It was fun. It was exciting.
Oh, my gosh. It was amazing.
Yeah.
First of all, I was paid probably $15-$17 bucks an hour. Back then, for a 15-year-old kid who was being dropped off by his mom, that was great money.
I don't want to date you, but when you say back then, 15 years old, you're talking, what, 80s?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm 51 right now. But it was incredible. I mean, the people, the most gorgeous people were there, right?
Yeah.
Me and my friend, I did it with my best friend, Sean, who's still my best friend.
Okay.
And the people, the food. At the end of these parties, we got to eat like kings. But I fell in love with this business early on. And then Spago, it was always...
You were like in the thick of the intersection of hospitality and entertainment.
Yes.
Because even Spago is entertainment, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The open kitchen.
All of it.
I was there mainly in the daytime, but I would stick around at night sometimes. And I remember Wolfgang, you know, had me like... You know, clean these baby strawberries or whatever, little tasks like that. Cause I was very inexperienced.
Yeah.
But I would stick around and just say, hey, I'll do anything you want. And it was just amazing to be there and to see the crowd and to see the food, the energy. Spago at that time was just outrageous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I never was there back then, back in the day. I can only imagine.
It's great.
Yeah. And for but for a kid, right? Like, and also the and then the opening, the premieres, like that's really, I mean, that's like that's like it, it's kind of like if you're in your industry, that's like that is like being on set.
Yeah. No, I fell in love with this business very early on. My parents, my mom Ellen, took me to Europe, and you know we ate in incredible restaurants.
Yes,
and saw that brand of service, which was very different.
Yes,
it was more of profession as opposed to what was going on in LA with people. Their profession was maybe being an actor.
Yes,
so it was different. But I fell in love with the hospitality side, the food side, everything.
So what finally made you want to shift gears, take the personal knowledge and sort of intuition you had developed, right, and apply it to what you do now? What was that? What was the light bulb, like the light bulb moment for that?
It was, it wasn't my idea. I had worked in restaurants, including Spago. I also worked for Wolfgang at Granita. I worked at Chaya.
Can you tell people what Granita was?
Granita was one of Wolfgang's restaurants in Malibu. It's not there any longer, but it was an amazing seafood Mediterranean spot.
Largely forgotten. One of the earlier things they tried to do, not long after Spago and Chinois.
Worked at the Grill on the Alley, Chaya, Vincenti. I worked at this hotel when it opened 17 years ago.
In the restaurant.
The Viceroy, yeah. I helped open that restaurant with Tim Goodell at the time, which had just won. He had just won a Food & Wine magazine Best New Chef.
Okay.
So I had been working in restaurants. I did everything from the kitchen, management, a lot of serving. I worked with Chadwick, with Ben Ford.
Okay.
Ruth Chris Steakhouse, San Francisco Hilton. I put in my time. And a woman named Joan Luther, who's no longer with us, she was a really, really big and respected restaurant publicist.
Okay.
And I got to know her from working in restaurants and through my family. And at a certain point, she said, Brad, you've been working in restaurants for so long. I get asked all the time if I know employees for all these clients of mine. She said, with your knowledge and your relationships with all of these chefs who are now opening their own restaurants these days, because I had worked with Josiah and Ben Ford and all these guys. We grew up together. So she said, you'd be perfect. You know, why don't you do some recruiting? You know, you'd be great for this. You have such a great base of knowledge for all these positions and all these, you know, chefs opening restaurants. And it came out of the blue, you know.
And you had never thought about doing anything.
Never
like
thought
that.
About that.
Had you paired up friends with jobs?
Yes, all the time.
Okay.
But it was mainly like busboys, servers. It was like
someone needed someone in a pinch.
Yeah,
you knew someone who the place had just closed.
Right.
You sent them over. It wasn't like a long selection process.
Yeah, because a server, you know, they may want a second job or a
You weren't pairing chefs up with
like a busser would always want a second job.
You weren't you weren't placing executive
chefs. No.
Or so even high-level sous.
Not at all.
Yeah.
So I thought about it for a while. I let it ruminate for a week or two. I said, Joan, this is an amazing idea. I think this would be great. She goes, great. You know what? Why don't you just do it casually? I'll help you out. I mean, a bunch of my clients need the help. You know. So I basically set up shop out of my son's bedroom at a rent control apartment in Santa Monica. And it really just started to slowly grow and grow. And, you know, my one of my very first clients was Susan Feniger.
Okay.
Okay, who we still work with today. I'm very close with her. She's going to be here. She's here at the conference.
Yep.
She's on your panel. It just sort of grew, you know?
Uh-huh.
And then at the time...
When did you start?
2003.
What?
Late 2003.
Coming up on 16.
And I was still working at the Grill on the Alley at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we had placed... Actually, me at the time, because it wasn't we back then... I'm used to saying we, but I placed Eric Klein, who had come from Spago, at Maple Drive.
Okay.
And I had closed that deal in the restroom of the Grill on the Alley, in between serving Cobb salads to people like Nancy Reagan and Sly Stallone and all these celebrities and agents.
Yeah.
The Grill on the Alley is a very famous power lunch place.
Okay.
One of the best waiter jobs in LA. Amazing. So when I closed that deal, and then he went on to get huge acclaim. He got like a 3-star review from Irene Verbilla in the LA Times.
Okay.
He got Food & Wine Best New Chef. He and I went to Aspen because that's where they celebrate all the Food & Wine Best New Chefs. That's when I said, okay, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to move out of the bedroom, my son's bedroom. I'm going to hire an employee.
Uh-huh.
And I was in touch with my good friend, Rick Christopher,
okay.
who I had worked with in restaurants.
Okay.
He was getting married. We were on the phone. And I told him what was going on. I'm moving into an office. He said, and I told him I should probably hire a full-time employee. I'm going to start looking. He's like, you should talk to Sarah, his wife. Talked to Sarah. Immediately, we connected. And
what was Sarah doing at the time?
Sarah was working at Chin Chin as a server.
Chin Chin?
On Sunset.
On Sunset, sure. Yeah. Ate there. I used to eat there when I was in the industry, the other industry.
And she was acting, too.
Yeah, okay.
We hit it off.
Yeah.
And she's still with me today as my senior director of culinary recruitment at BMRS.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. And then you sort of put the band together.
Yep, slowly hired. You know, we just slowly grew, you know. So it was me and Sarah. Then we hired, you know, another person. And it just grew basically to the team that we are. It's me plus seven now.
How many are there? I mean, in New York, there's, and I know you do business like everywhere, but in New York, there's like a couple of people that people mention, you know, who are based there. There's very few. Is this still a pretty small industry?
No, I think there's a lot of recruiting firms and a lot of recruiters.
No, but I mean who specifically do what you do.
A lot of them do not specialize in the chef-driven world, the boutique restaurants, the small groups.
Right.
Because it really takes an understanding
of
the nuances of the business.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes. Well, that's sort of that question I was asking before. Yeah.
Really, sometimes when we get new clients, they don't understand why we're spending an hour with them on the phone or visiting them and eating at their restaurants and asking all these questions. And it's clear. We want to know. We are a reflection of you guys. When we're talking to these candidates, we really want to know what the job is, what you're looking for, what your business is like, so we can accurately reflect the position.
Yeah, no, I get that. No, it's like, right, and in the restaurant industry, for people who are listening who aren't in that business, you know, it's not like it really isn't, even with what you just described, anything like the corporate world where people might be interviewing for like 6 months, literally just going layer and layer and layer through a company. There's not those kind of, they're not fail safes because sometimes things still don't work out, but that's not how it works in the restaurant business.
No.
It's usually very timely need that someone has to fill, or often. It's often a very big position that needs to be filled in a fraction of the time I just described.
Well, it's even more time sensitive these days because there's such a high demand for good people.
Yes.
That if you're interviewing a candidate and he or she is a really good candidate, if you wait days or weeks, they are accepting another offer.
It's like jumping on a New York City apartment rental.
Insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's gotten, you got to jump.
So time sensitive over the last year or two.
Okay. So the obvious things to me that somebody who does what you do would need to be able to evaluate well, the two obvious things are the food piece.
Yes.
And the management piece.
Right.
What am I not thinking of?
It's
that you might try to check references for or suss out.
References.
No. In terms of what's the makeup of somebody you might be looking to place in a chef position that may not be obvious to someone who doesn't do that? If there is something beyond the food and the management piece.
Yeah, it's about team assembly, and it's about the structure of the management team at the existing operation.
Okay.
So really understanding, if it's a general manager, what support do they have? What are the financials? Where are they done? Is there an in-house bookkeeper? Who does the payroll, right? What's the support? Do you want this person to be more of a maitre d' training floor presence?
Yes.
Or do they need to know the financials, the budgeting, the forecasting, the payroll, the purchasing, the food costs?
Yes.
All of this stuff. Because every operation is different, and all of those things need to be handled in a restaurant, but they can be put together in so many different ways.
Okay.
So it's about knowing all of those nuances and knowing what the specific need for the position is, so you can look for the talent and the qualifications in the person to fit that operation.
Okay. So you're saying it's always a different list.
Always different.
Of what you're looking for.
Yes.
Let's talk about people in the kitchen side. Okay. Is there something and maybe this is another, like, there's no one size fits all, but is there one thing or a short list of things that you see that's maybe even hard to describe easily right now, right? Like, is there something that will you observe things that might seem negligible to a casual observer and it'll give you some sort of insight into the person where all of a sudden, like, you know, something just clicks in your head and you're like, that's the, I just know it right now. Like, I have to go prove it now, but I know this is going to be the one.
I mean,
can you just, like, is it just like almost an animal thing at this point?
If a chef has reached a point in his career that they're sort of going through the motions and there isn't a lot of that passion.
Yeah.
And even the hospitality vibe.
Yeah.
It's not a good sign at all. And when you interview someone, you can sort of see that.
So it's more likely that something will strike you that'll take someone off your candidate list than something that'll make you realize instantly they're the one.
It's both. I mean,
yeah.
When you see an exceptional person and you talk to them and there's that, you know, that spark and that light and that passion, you sort of know right away.
To me, in a cook, like a chef, like when I see someone who's like, I have no problem with anyone who isn't, but they tend to be very kind of like clean cut, you know, tight in appearance. I don't mean they don't have tattoos and all that, but they're not unkempt. They seem to have a list in their head that takes them through the next 3 days, and you just get this vibe like they're on top of everything.
Right. Yeah.
Everything. I just was editing on my flight in today an interview with Marcus Glocker from Batard and Augustine in New York. And he was saying that, like, chefs that he came up with taught him that even when you got to the position of executive chef, you need to go through everybody's fridge.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm,
you need to know every detail of your kitchen, even though you have people in charge of those individual stations, right? Yeah. I feel like the kind of person who does these kind of things, you can kind of, even I feel like I can spot them right away. I don't know if they're nice people. I don't know if they're screamers.
You know what? There's so many elements that go into making a great chef now.
Yeah.
And if you don't have most of them or all of them, you can only go so far.
Even now, even with the demand.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have to have the organizational skills.
Yeah.
You have to have the creativity.
Yeah.
You have to have the people skills now more than ever.
Yeah.
And you have to have a financial mind too, because the financials and the food cost and the budgeting and the labor, it's essential now. If your food is absolutely amazing, but you cannot work with people and your costs are out of line, it's over.
Yeah.
You know, I'll give you an example. Hillstone.
Okay.
The food is good.
Well, I don't know if people know what that is, because the Hillstone is also Houston's. It's a steak, basically a steakhouse. Chain seems too casual for what it is.
Well, they have a few different concepts. It's very straightforward cuisine. You know, it's not really chef-driven, but it's good, and they run an amazing business, and they're very successful.
No, I know, but I'm saying the thing I said about the name was, is they are they a client of yours?
No.
Okay, so my understanding is, and I will check this before I air the episode, is that if you have multi-units of the same concept, above a certain number, or if you're in a certain number of states, you have to, by law, disclose the calorie counts and all that, right? So Houston's and Hillstone's are essentially the same thing, but they're not. And that, my understanding is that's actually the reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, although Bandera is a slightly different than...
Yeah, but those first... Hillstone and Houston's are basically the same.
Yeah.
They got the artichoke spinach dip, and the which is really good.
Some locations have sushi, some don't.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, that's a cul-de-sac. But the point of that was what... Cause I just thought of something that I would think maybe sometimes you have to evaluate. Somebody's... two things. Marketing prowess... social media followers. Are they good on camera? Is this someone who could go on the Today Show, you know, or be on YouTube? And also, is this someone who knows how to, at the very least, not have unforced errors in the media or on social media? Does this ever come up in hiring?
Not so much. The other things that I mentioned, the creativity, the working with people, the organization, the cost controls, that stuff you have to have. The other stuff, the marketability and all that, you know, there's plenty of awkward chefs that are not good on Instagram that are highly successful and highly acclaimed, you know?
Yeah, I'm not disputing that. I just know that it's also more competitive than ever right now. So I just wonder if people would want promotability, let's call it, to be a piece of the puzzle.
Oh, it's definitely a piece.
Okay.
But a lot of times, especially these days, the younger chefs are way too focused on that piece and they're not good on the other things and they don't think the other things are important.
What else are we talking about today?
Tell me. I think it's time to talk about you.
What?
Yeah.
What are you going to talk about me? What are you going to talk about me?
So,
is this about to turn into a surprise party?
It's a surprise.
Are people about to come in?
The conference got a little crazy and I was running around all over the place.
Yeah.
And we never had the whole 550 attendees in one spot. So I wasn't able to give this to you, but I do have something for you.
Oh my gosh.
It's a little token from the LA Chef Conference for you. Can you open that?
I'm getting a gift on air.
It is an award.
Linda said like hello, and now she's like opening my gift box. What did you do?
It's the LA Chef Conference 2019.
What did you do?
Award.
Oh my God. Oh my God. We'll take this will be our picture.
Contributions to our industry.
Oh my God. Look at this. It's a microphone. It's a little silver microphone with my name.
I just want to say. Sweet.
Oh, it actually says LA Chef Conference 2019 Award for Contributions to Our Industry. Wow.
What you do for our industry, Andrew,
you're gonna embarrass me.
Is amazing.
Thank you.
I read your comments on your channels.
Instagram and stuff.
Everything.
Yeah.
And what you do for the people in the industry and the young cooks who listen to you while they're prepping and everybody at all levels in the industry is amazing. And thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
And thank you for coming out.
I don't even know how to say it. Verklempt? How do you say it? You think I should know. I dropped out of Hebrew school.
You are a mensch.
Thank you, Brad. I can't let you say any more because I don't want to get any more comments about how I talk about myself too much. But thank you very much. That's very nice of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
We really appreciate you coming all the way from New York to be an important part of the LA
Chef
Conference.
I'm excited that I was able to be here for it.
Yes.
What do you have sitting here, by the way? Is this a script? Is this else? Is this for tomorrow?
You know, in case you had specific questions about the conference and what went down and everything.
No, I can't believe you got this little microphone for this. This is so great.
Where's that going to go in your office?
It'll go in my office. It'll go on my desk. I have a larger desk than a writer needs. A writer doesn't really need a desk. You just need a MacBook Air.
What would Caitlin say about that?
She'll think this was so sweet. Thank you, Brad.
You're welcome.
What else do you want to talk about? Where are you from? You're obviously from California.
Yeah, I grew up here starting when I was about 5 years old.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in Southern California?
Yes, Beverly Hills.
Okay. When you were, you described discovering the industry very young, right?
Yes.
But before that, did you ever have any notion you would do? I mean, the generation that you are of was one of the, you know, that was still a point in time where it was like, you know, you come from a nice family and you come home one day and say, you know what, guys, I want to be a cook. That usually doesn't go over too well. Or even I want to work in the restaurant business. Not like it does now. This wasn't, we weren't watching people open restaurants on, you know, network television shows.
So what happened was I was always in love and fascinated by food, even before I started working. Yeah.
Yeah.
Always, always. My mom was an amazing cook. We had a housekeeper named Elvia, who was an incredible cook.
So what background? Culturally?
Mexico. Yeah.
Did she cook that stuff for you?
Yeah, and just amazing.
And whatever.
Stuff that my mom would ask her to make.
Like out of a cookbook or something?
Just things my mom would put together and then teach her and then she would do it.
And then she would do it and she would just like
Elvia was like my mom's sous chef. And then my mom would come and finish.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
But I was always into it. So when I went to college, I went to UC Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
Worked at El Encanto Hotel in Santa Barbara, worked at the UCSB Faculty Club.
But what did you go to college for?
My major was sociology.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I was sort of floating around. And
You didn't know what you were going to do.
I loved sociology.
Yeah. Well, it makes total sense with what you ended up doing, right?
Yeah, it did. It did. And my parents were always my family, very, very supportive of me being in the industry, doing whatever I want. However, I did sort of always know that I wasn't going to be a chef. I didn't have that creativity. And I always really knew that I didn't want to become a chef. But when I graduated from college, I was accepted to Cornell for hotel restaurant management, the master's program.
Okay.
My parents were going to help me. I was accepted.
Yeah.
I had never gone to visit there before I was accepted. So right after, upon graduation or close to graduating, I went out there. I visited Cornell. And something told me, Brad, do not go here. It's not the right move for you. There were a bunch of little kids running around in suits and ties. I was coming from UC Santa Barbara.
Right.
I just didn't feel it. And you know what? Thank goodness I didn't, because I, who knows where I'd be an executive.
That might have driven you out of the business.
Or I'd be an executive with Hilton right now, which doesn't fit me. This fits me perfectly.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. The sociology piece is very interesting.
Yeah.
All right. What, I feel bad that Linda's just sitting here.
No, it's fun to hear him talk about his story and to tell it to you. We've you know, been over it many, many times over the years, and
sure.
I have to laugh because, you know, him even saying he's from Beverly Hills when we first met, he didn't want to tell me that he was, you know, raised in Beverly Hills. He told me, oh, I'm from Los Angeles. I'm like, yeah, but where in Los Angeles? And so he's never wanted to have, you know, any airs or appearances of, you know, having been, you know, very privileged. And he's always been such a hard worker. Ever since I've known him, he's always been doing at least three different things. He has a passion for reggae, so he's a writer, or was a writer. You're a writer for an online blog for Reggae Magazine, or what is it? Reggaeville. And, you know, he was a waiter. He always had two or three different gigs that were going on at the same time. So he really just has always been somebody who needed to have his mind busy and to be doing things that he thought, you know, were important. So.
And where are you from?
Me? Oh, I'm from the Midwest. I'm from Minnesota.
Oh, you are. Okay.
Can you hear it in the accent?
I couldn't place the accent to save my life. I would not have guessed Minnesota.
Oh, no, from Minnesota.
And can I ask how you guys met? Is that a tellable story?
Oh, my gosh. So his version differs from my version. Great. So I don't know.
Well, I don't know. Is this going to... Is this off the record?
No, his best friend, Sean, that he talked about earlier, introduced us. We had a friend in common. And so we were out at a house party, and Brad was just getting off from work, and he came out to the house party, and we just hit it off. We talked like all night long. It was so much fun. And then at the time, I had a boyfriend, so it was all fun and friends, but...
It was all fun and friends until somebody loses their car.
She withheld that information from me all night. We had been talking about everything.
Yeah.
Everything. She neglected to mention
that. And then
that
the sun came
fact.
Out, and it was like,
Well, the sun did come out because we were at an underground club in downtown LA.
And instead of finding out you were in love with a vampire, you found out you were in love with someone. But boyfriend and married is two different things.
She wouldn't give me her phone number. However,
oh, I see.
However, she had told me where she worked. Ethan Allen Furniture Store in West LA.
All right.
So that coming week, of course, I had to make an appearance.
Yeah, sure.
At Ethan Allen, and the rest is history.
The rest is history. All right. Well, I think we're coming up on our preordained time frame. What do you do? How are you so calm? You know what? You're like a producer this week.
Yeah.
Because when I used to work for a producer, they used to say, like, when, you know, if the producer's done their job, then when you're at the moment where you're about to say action for the first time, you're just like, everyone's got their jobs and you're just there to put out fires.
My team.
God forbid.
Sarah, Jackie, Erica, Tatum, Sadie, Kelly, Margot have been absolutely amazing, and they're so organized. Kelly had a spreadsheet made about where all the bottles of water and the cases of water were going throughout the conference.
That's good.
The spreadsheet.
Yes.
So it's been incredible.
She probably worked for Steve Hansen in a previous job. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks
for flying me out here to,
of course,
you know, be part of this event.
Thank you for what you do for the industry, Andrew.
Thank you, Brad. I appreciate it. All right, you guys. Thanks. Let's go mingle.
Let's go do it.
Okay, and next up, Caitlin, is Della Gossett. Della is, as many people are in this industry, a career changer. Came to the professional kitchen a bit on the late side. Made up for lost time. Spent several years with Charlie Trotter, the late Charlie Trotter in Chicago. Currently is with Wolfgang Puck's Spago in Beverly Hills. Never met her before. Couldn't have been nicer by email. It's a really interesting job she has. It's more multifaceted than I would have thought because of the number of the types of events that come through and are connected to that restaurant. You would probably be a pastry chef if you were going to be a chef of any kind.
I thought about that
for a minute. For a minute. Yeah. But I think you more thought you might open a bakery.
Yeah, it was a, you're right.
I don't think you would have wanted to cook for service.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
But if I had a choice, that would probably be what I would do.
Anyway, in all honesty, we're going to make these intros a little quick because A, I have to deliver the show today, and B, we have to get to an appointment. We're dealing with a parenting issue this week.
And we'd be better.
We have to get to an appointment at the school. So with that, here is pastry chef Della Gossett of Spago Restaurant in Beverly Hills. If I'm not mistaken, you came here from Chicago?
I did. I came here. I've been with Chef Wolfgang for about 6 years now at Spago.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So when you, we're sitting outside. It's a spectacular day.
It's so beautiful.
You said to me, I said, you've been here about 6 years.
Yes.
And you said, yes, I love it. Do you ever, does this ever become, you came here, you didn't come here as like a kid or, in your early professional days. You came here as a fully formed adult from a place that's very cold in the winter. And do you ever take it for granted or does it still just always seem noteworthy?
It's inspiring.
Inspiring.
It's inspiring.
How do you mean that?
Well, I think actually one of the reasons why I moved to California was because of my admiration for the farmers market. I mean, even when I was in Chicago, I would go to the Green City Market almost every Wednesday, pick up all my produce, and then take it back to the restaurant. And I could only do that so many months out of the year.
Right, yeah.
You know?
Same in New York where I am,
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I would come out to California to vacation, and I remember going to the farmers market and just being awestruck by the produce.
Are we talking the Third Street Market? Are we talking the Santa Monica Wednesday Market?
The Santa Monica Wednesday Market.
Yeah. I mean, that's like a pilgrim. I'm leaving here Wednesday this week. We're talking on a Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking someone who's never been to the market. We're going to have coffee and whatever we can scrounge around to eat. And but they've never been there, and I can't wait because it is. I think it might be the best one in the country.
I think it is. I mean,
which is saying something at this point.
It really is. I mean, I'm spoiled now because now I've tasted delicious strawberries. They're so sweet. You know, they're not white inside. They actually have color and peaches and nectarines that I've never tasted before. Just so naturally sweet right off the tree. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
It's great. So when you say inspiring, do you mean all of the whole package, the weather, the produce?
The whole package.
The whole package.
I mean, I feel guilty talking to my family back in Chicago because they're like, oh, it's April and it's snowing here. And I'm like, oh, wow, I'm sorry, but it's sunny and beautiful. And I just went to the beach today. And, you know, tomorrow I might drive out to the desert or whatever. I mean, it's pretty great. There's a lot of things to do.
Yeah. Can we just say somebody just went by on what normally would be something that you cart produce around or something, and they were using it as a skateboard. Did you see it?
I didn't see
that. Yeah, that's
pretty cool.
A person riding that.
Yeah, you don't see that in Chicago.
No. I'm always interested in, and correct me if I'm wrong about how you go about it, but we haven't had that many pastry chefs on the show, but what always interests me is, I think, you know, certainly for the last several decades, right, pastry chefs are seen as sort of creative, distinct as a savory chef, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like part of the job, which this is always really interesting to me to try to square this, is that you spent years with Charlie Trotter,
yes,
and you're now at Spago,
yes,
just two very different types of restaurants,
yes.
I think in the most cases, one of the jobs of a pastry chef is to be able to adapt, to do something in your own style, but to morph into something that would make sense at the end of... You always come last in the sequence.
Yes,
in sequence. So what you do has to be sort of a suitable... It's like you're writing like a coda for someone else's piece of music. Does that make sense?
Exactly. Oh, absolutely.
Is that what it feels like?
Well, going into a fine dining restaurant and, for example, working within the tasting menu, you do have to kind of follow the lead of what the chef is doing. You don't want to repeat ingredients yep. or things like that, and you kind of want to stay in the same vibe.
Right.
So it's not like, okay, you have this beautiful, eloquent meal, and then you end with a piece of pie.
Yes,
right. So, you know, you could do something like that, meaning maybe take some of the elements of a delicious pie that's in season and change it to be more fine dining.
Like riff on it.
Like
or,
riff on yeah. it, exactly. But yeah, I mean, I've definitely been able, I think one of the most exciting parts of being a pastry chef is, or for me, is to be able to constantly change and grow. I mean, mm-hmm. when I was at Charlie Trotter's, I was there for almost 10 years,
yeah.
and it was all fine dining tasting menu.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came to work for Chef Wolfgang, and boy, there is so, not only are there tasting menus, but there's a lunch there, which we never did at Charlie Trotter's.
Yep.
There's a banquet style. There's special events. There's lots of off-site events. There's birthday cakes, wedding cakes, all types of things. And it's been really exciting for me. I mean,
so this all falls under your auspices and direction?
It does.
Wow.
And
did you have to learn new... did you have to pick up new things that you hadn't ever done? Or had you pretty much done at least a little of all of this that you just listed?
Oh, no. I mean...
Like, had you done wedding cakes before?
No, no. Never.
And that's a very specific thing.
Yeah, never wedding cakes. I mean, even just to roll fondant and put it on a cake is really... It's you have to be very skilled, and I try my best.
Yeah.
But I also have an amazing team at work, and so if it's something that, like a fondant cake, that I'm not 100% comfortable doing, then I try to hire amazing people that will be able to do something like that.
Yeah, yeah. So. It's funny. I remember when my wife and I got married, I didn't know that, and she said we have to find someone who does wedding cakes, and I said, well, just let's go to a bakery. She said, no. And she gave me the whole fondant talk.
Right.
And, yeah, this was in 2000 when everything was, I don't know what it's like now, but everything was fondant for weddings.
Yeah, now it's changed. I mean, whatever the flow of Instagram is, okay. that's where it goes. it's very exciting to be a pastry chef. I mean, I am never bored.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Charlie used to say, you must never become complacent.
Mm-hmm.
And that is true. If that's the way you want to live your life,
yes.
and to lead an exciting pastry chef life, that's yes. what you should do. Learn something about bread. Learn something about chocolate, sculpture, wedding cakes, how to make a proper pie, how to make a proper cookie, how to make something super delicious. I mean, it's just... It all falls under that realm if that's what you want to do as a pastry chef.
Yeah. So you can sort of, and I assume you can sort of even just follow, how do I put this? You could be a little spontaneous, like you can within the confines of one job. Like when you're a young cook, right, and you're figuring out where to go next, mm-hmm. you oftentimes have to go to a new job to try to do a new thing or try something in a different style.
Yes.
But it sounds like what you're saying in the job you're in now, you could read about something or get just kind of a little tug towards something, and you could find a way to fit that into one of these channels you're describing.
Absolutely. I always say to people, you know, my job is not black and white. There are lots of gray areas,
mm-hmm.
and there are lots of things that get thrown at me all the time.
Right.
I mean, I have to be able to be open to spontaneity, for sure.
Yeah.
There are always things that are changing.
Yeah.
And for some people, that could be really stressful.
Yes.
But you kind of have to embrace it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you never know when someone might want a birthday cake in an hour with specific things on it.
Right.
And you just have to make it happen.
Yeah.
I tell everyone, like, underneath my chef jacket, I have a shirt that says, make it happen.
Yeah. It's the year. I mean, I've had a number of chefs say to me that you all are in the, you know, the business of saying yes.
Absolutely. Yes, chef.
Yeah,
that's what
we chef.
Say.
That's it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And not just to chefs. I mean, that's kind of the instinct.
Exactly.
How did you settle on pastry when you were coming up? Was it always where you were headed? Were you going to be more of a generalist and then gravitated toward it? What sort of drew you to that side of the force?
Well, I actually, when I started culinary school in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
I wasn't even really interested in pastry, although I loved eating it.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually have a background in more savory cooking
mm-hmm.
to begin with. But my first job fine dining job was at Trio in Evanston.
This is with Gail Gand?
Yes, with Gail Gand. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of walked in the door saying, I'll do anything you want. I will be the head potato scrubber. I really don't care. I just want to be in a kitchen.
Yeah.
So I guess it just, the pastry cure kind of morphed there. They needed someone in garmager first, and pastry, where I just kind of scoop sorbets all day at dinner. And then they said, oh, we need someone in the bake shop. We need someone in the bread department. So then I started baking bread. And so that kind of morphed into pastry. And I just found myself, because I have an art background, that I was really drawn into the magic of pastry.
What kind of art were you practicing?
Well, I have a degree in elementary and high school art education. So
okay.
I dabbled in a lot of things, from ceramics to jewelry to things like painting. But my minor was in drawing and painting.
Okay. Interesting. So that translates to some extent.
Absolutely.
Or applies.
Yes.
What did you... did I read right? Did you teach pastry as well?
I did. In between working with Chef Trotter and Chef Wolfgang, I was a chef instructor at the French Pastry School.
Okay.
So I thought that was a good way to tie in my educational aspect to what I did, teaching and my love of pastry. And that's what I did.
Did you enjoy doing that?
It was one of the best decisions I ever made in my life.
How long did you spend doing it?
I was there for almost 3 years.
Okay, that's a fair amount of time.
And
did you think about staying there for good? Did that ever cross your mind, or were you always going to get back into the restaurant side?
That was kind of a place where I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. I didn't think I'd ever want to be in a restaurant again, but it just
threw me in.
But it was an amazing experience. It's an amazing pastry school, the French pastry school.
Yeah.
I learned so much there in such a short amount of time. And I was able to help with the with some competitions, which was really fun, something I'd never thought I'd ever do. So it was a great experience.
Can you speak to the competition piece for just a minute? Because it's so interesting to me. I just had this conversation with Kelly Fields was on.
Okay.
And we were talking, and to be honest, we were talking about the differences in sort of the psychology. It's all overgeneralizing, right? But between men and women. And I had written a book about the Bocuse d'Or competition.
Okay.
And I made this comment that people assume that at least the American effort is very sexist, because there's almost never any women trying out to be on the team. And the truth is, there just aren't that many women trying out to be on that team. Like, they're just not drawn to it the way guys are. That competition, which is like a 5-hour, very show-offy, right? And
exactly.
And even internationally, I've been out to Lyon to see it. You barely even ever see any women commis in the competition. So when I was going over your bios, getting ready to talk to you, and I saw a competition in there, I was just curious to ask you about that. Like, what drew you to it? Did you enjoy it? Or was it your students who were competing?
No, it wasn't my students. I worked with three amazing pastry chefs, Chef Donald Russell, Josh Johnson, and Scott Green.
Okay.
And so we worked together for almost 2 years on the national pastry team, and then it went on to the world pastry team.
Wow.
And I wasn't actually on the floor, you know, making chocolate sculptures or sugar. I was kind of in the background. I was like the commis. I was the one who was scaling the ingredients and, helping them maybe come up with a few flavor profiles and tasting, and just being a huge support to them. I mean, no one really understands, unless they've been in a competition, how much work goes in it.
The practicing, the dry runs.
Yeah, over and over and over again. I don't think I had... I rarely had weekends off for those 2 years. I mean, it was working at the school, teaching, and then maybe after work we'd go through competitions, talk about it. And then on the weekends we compete. Or not compete, but practice.
You have spent, I mean, I would almost put Gail Gann for people who remember in this category, but I would for sure put Chef Trotter and Wolfgang Puck in this category. You went to work at two restaurants that when you got there were already sort of, I mean, you could use whatever word you want, legendary, iconic institutions. Is that something that's particularly appealing to you, or was that a coincidence? And what's it like to go into a job at a place that has as much history as those two restaurants?
Well, you know, I'm a career changer. So I didn't start until later in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was already an elementary and high school art teacher at one point. And so I thought, you know, if I'm going to make this career change, I am not messing around. Okay. So I just went to the top.
So and for you, that's what it was about. It was about.
That's what it was about. I mean, it's like that. That's what I'm going to go for. And, you know, I'm going to reach for the stars. And that's where it was. And after doing lots of research and, you know, reading magazines and talking to people, you know, I decided I'm just going to walk in the door and I'm just going to, you know, my first job was at Trio in Evanston. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. I just kind of walked in the door. After, by the way, walking around the block 5 times, I didn't even have enough guts to walk in.
This is when you went to ask for the job?
This is when I went to go ask for the job. Yeah. I didn't even know they had a job opening.
Yeah, I think this is less, I mean, I know people still do it, but it used to, not that long ago, the way you got into a kitchen is you showed up, if they served lunch, you showed up between lunch and dinner at the kitchen door.
Absolutely.
And you said, I will work for you. And often you said, I will work for you for free.
Absolutely.
And a lot of great careers started that way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I still...
That was the move.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I've definitely hired people.
Sure.
At the back door, they had their knife kit in hand. And I said, okay, come on in and
show
let's
us
talk.
What you can do.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you like... I mean, for me as an observer, that is such a... You know, this notion of like wandering the land with a knife kit and like showing up. And I mean, I know people who went to plenty of people because I wrote that book who went to France and did that in France. And a lot of them didn't even speak French. Like that back when you really needed to go overseas to get that, like almost like a finishing school piece.
Exactly.
You know, they did that over there not speaking the language. But I just find that so romantic. The idea that you can do, like if you have the gumption.
Right.
Maybe you have to walk around the block a few times, but if you're willing to put yourself out there like that,
exactly.
I mean, look where you are now. It's kind of amazing.
Exactly. For me, it wasn't a choice. That's what I needed to do. And I think that is what draws you in the kitchen and actually what keeps you in a kitchen. I mean, you can't work in a kitchen and go through everything, you know, that a kitchen goes through and not love what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not saying it's perfect and it's always romantic. That's not for sure. But there are some days that are really tough, and you're like kind of in the trenches with the rest of the cooks.
Yes.
And you have to make it happen.
Yes.
And you're like, oh my gosh, why am I doing this? But you know, it's that thing that's in your core that makes you want to be there.
Yeah. What difference is Chicago, big food city, L.A., huge food city.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference for someone who came here, you know, long enough ago to have a real sense of it here? How's it different, the community?
I don't know if there's a huge difference. You know, I just said to someone yesterday that it's amazing what a small world it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there are similarities. I mean, they're both big, huge food communities. There's a lot of culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's different kinds of cuisine, which is really interesting. Tiny little neighborhoods that you can go to and eat the best pho or you know, have the best tacos.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are big similarities. And I don't know if there's a big difference other than, you know, the sunshine and the produce.
Yeah, exactly. So that felt like an easy, that was an easy transition for you.
For me, it was an easy transition.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So just tell me, at Spago, what is something that you've put on the menu there that kind of for you sums up your style, your sensibility, what you do, or just a favorite thing of your own?
Well, something that I've been dabbling in the past couple of years is, you know, I'm always trying to find inspiration. And so one of the things that I'm inspired in is art and actually fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I have been dabbling in is being inspired by an artist. So one of the first desserts I did at Spago, inspired by the artist series, was Frank Gehry.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of did a dessert that was architectural, almost in the style of the Disney building. And then I found an artist by the name Analia Saban. She's an LA artist. Most of these are LA artists, by the way. I mean, LA is probably one of the hottest hubs for contemporary art in the world. And So I found an artist, Analia Saban, and was very attracted to what she did and inspired. And so I created a dessert kind of around what one of her pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the same with fashion. I mean, for a short time, I kind of dabbled with a Chicago designer when I was in Chicago. I mean, mm-hmm. I didn't do any designing, but I was kind of like behind the scenes production sure. manager, and because I've always been interested in fashion as well. And so a huge inspirational fashion designer that I've admired is Alexander McQueen.
Mm-hmm.
Because he
sure.
broke so many molds.
Yeah.
And so I have a dessert on the menu now that is inspired by Alexander McQueen. So those are things that I think really pull me in. Something that's not something that means something to me.
Gives you a challenge.
It gives me a challenge.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Gives you a structure. Yeah.
Yes.
Now, do you, is there any identification of these as inspired by so-and-so, or is that just your own little secret? Like on the menu, does it indicate that at
it
all?
Does. It does. It doesn't indicate on the menu.
Okay. And have you had these artists come in and see what you've done with their inspiration?
Well, I have met Frank Gehry.
Yeah.
And I have met Analia Saban, for sure.
And have they had these desserts?
I'm not 100% sure about Frank Gehry, uh-huh. but Analia Saban, for sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And was that, you're smiling big when you say that, so I assume that was a good experience for you?
Yes. She's an amazingly sweet, humble person.
So she was touched by it.
She was, I believe so. Yes. And so that was really, that was like an out-of-body experience. I mean, yeah. I couldn't believe that she actually came to the restaurant and I got to serve her the dessert. And I,
that's,
you know,
great.
That was really cool. Yeah.
Excellent. All right. Well, I know you have a talk soon. Thanks for doing this with me.
Thank you.
I'm
Thank
glad
you
we
so
got
much.
To meet. And I have to say, I don't usually confess this. I have not been to the current Spago location. I've been there. I've never eaten there.
Well,
so I'll
come on.
I'm going to come in and maybe I'll just come in for dessert. No, I won't do that. I'll come in for a full meal, but I'll leave room for plenty of room for dessert.
Please leave room for dessert, or you'll get dessert first.
Okay, or I'll have dessert first. We'll start a new thing. Okay, right. Great meeting you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And next up, Caitlin, is Michael Chmerudzki. I don't think you know him. He has Providence Restaurant in Los Angeles. Providence is easily the fanciest restaurant I've ever been to in L.A. It's not what most people think of as the kind of place you would go in Los Angeles. He and his partner Donato also have Connie and Ted's restaurant, a more casual place.
I've been there.
Oh, you've been there?
Yep.
I've not been
it's
there.
It's really fun.
Yeah.
It's very near my hotel.
But, you know, Michael, first of all, I say this in the interview, I wouldn't have known that he'd been around as long as he had, because like many Los Angelinos, he just looks so freaking healthy and happy and unburdened, even though he's running a very serious restaurant. As much as probably anybody I can think of, he is really happy the Michelin Guide is coming back, because he's, I don't want to jinx anything, but he has a restaurant that is very much in the mold of great Michelin restaurants. But he makes, it's not what you think of when you think of LA dining. You know, you don't think of getting dressed up a little bit. You don't think of fancy, you know, necessarily fancy plating or, but he, that's his orientation. That's all he's ever wanted to do. We talk about how he's made it work there. And I think he's made it work brilliantly. The Providence is just a spectacularly great restaurant on every level. I would say more, except that I can't, or the show won't air till next week. So with that, my first ever chat with, I'm sorry, I do have to say this. He just won, after 8 or 9 nominations, one of those exquisitely painful, you know, renomination things, you know, at the Beard Awards. He finally won Best Chef West.
Aww.
Yeah. Years ago, I remember Jeremiah Tower had a similar thing. I mean, it happens. But he finally got the award. And everybody was very happy for him, as was I. So he's still kind of basking in the glow of that. And I just wanted to acknowledge that. And here is my conversation with Michael Chmerudzki. I hope you enjoy it. All right. So first of all, Mike, we barely know each other.
Yeah.
I had lunch years ago with some regulars, the famous Manny
Klausners.
And Willette Klausner. That's a name that LA industry people will know.
Yeah, of course.
In what do you call it? The chef's room?
The chef's table, yeah.
The chef's table, which is basically in the kitchen separated by a glass
right.
wall.
It's like a little fishbowl.
Yeah. I think that's the only time I'd ever met you
yeah.
until we saw each other at the Beard Awards.
Right.
So I have to ask, What was that? I mean, you 9-time nominee?
So, yeah.
For Best Chef West?
Well, I think 8 times for that, but I also got nominated. We got nominated, Providence did, for Best New Restaurant back in 06.
Okay.
We were notified by fax, so that'll tell you just how much time passed.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a long time
that
ago.
That even seems like it was behind the times for 06.
I know. Maybe it was. But,
anyway.
I don't know. Was Twitter around in 2006?
I don't know if Twitter was, but you certainly could have gotten an email.
Yeah. But it seems, I don't think, like, if Twitter was around, I wasn't on it.
Yeah.
And I really didn't have much concept of what, you know, the Beard Awards at that point. I mean, yeah. I knew they existed and that kind of thing, but
yeah.
It was, you know, that was like something that happened in New York and, you know.
Right.
And, you know, we certainly weren't expecting it, but I remember I was in the kitchen and I was cutting fish.
Yeah.
And my wife came down with a piece of paper in her hand. She goes, "We've got a big problem." And I was like, "Oh, shit." Because in the restaurant world, that could mean so
Many
things.
Yeah.
And yeah, and then she showed it to me, and I had to read it like 3 times to figure out what exactly it was saying. But you know,
right.
I was pretty pleased.
Uh huh. Yeah, as one would be.
Yeah.
So to finally win it, what was the psychology of it for you? Because it was
I hadn't been
to the awards since they moved to Chicago.
Yeah, I mean,
and I had forgotten the intensity, like when people were winning, and like, you know, howling, screaming, and it was pretty. And but to be denied that so many times, and then finally have it. What was that moment like?
It was pretty crazy. You know, I sat there. It was honestly, you know, the day of. I mean, I can just tell you, like, of all the times that I've been nominated, like, the day of, you're just, like, nervous and tense and thinking of all the reasons why you wouldn't win it or shouldn't win it.
Yeah.
And so the psychology is definitely difficult. And I think, you know, I know it wears on my wife, too, because she always comes with me. And, you know, my partner Donato and his wife always go as well. And so, you know, you spend the day kind of like wringing your hands and trying to not think about it and, you know, do other things.
Mm-hmm.
That morning, my wife and I, we had a nice walk through the park. I think it's Wicker Park. I don't know. But it's that park in Chicago where there's all the statues and there's art installations. It's where Frank Gehry has that incredible band shell. And we
kind of
walked around there and, you know, killed time that way. And then, you know, we went and had a nice lunch at Public Inn. And then, you know, made our way to the awards and... yeah, I mean, when they finally called my name, it's elation, you know? I mean,
yeah.
I was super happy. You know, first thing I did was take a few steps back to the row behind me and give my friend David Kinch a hug, because he's been a friend and a supporter.
Know him from interviewing him, but I consider him a friend now.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
If you get along with him, he shows up.
Yeah, he's a great guy. So, yeah. I mean, that was the first thing I did. I gave my wife a big kiss, and I walked down the aisle, and, you know, Donnie, you know, Paul's partner, gave me a big hug, and Tom Colicchio gave me a big hug, and, you know, I don't know, getting up to the stage and walking across it, it's all sorts of emotion.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it came time to, like, deliver this little speech that I'd written on my notes on my phone, and I couldn't read it at all because... everyone was texting me and sending notes.
All this stuff kept popping up
on my phone. Yeah, and I couldn't even read what I wrote, so I just basically had to wing it.
Yeah, you did fine.
Yeah, but it was great, you know. And then I don't know. I mean, a chef that I used to work for many years ago when I was working with Larry Fulgione, Melissa Kelly. She sent me a message and said, enjoy tonight. It's like, you know, it's like being Cinderella for the night, you know, and then go out and get drunk.
Wasn't she the one who was at the old Chatham sheep herding for years?
She was there. And
in upstate New York.
Right.
Yeah.
And my wife and I worked for her when she was at the Beekman 1776 Tavern.
Oh, okay.
Or 1766 Tavern.
That was a Fulgione property.
That was a Larry Fulgione place. Which
also
is
upstate
at the
New
Beekman
York.
Arms in Rhinebeck.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, my wife and I, we worked for Larry in the city. And then when we graduated from school, we worked for Larry... up there in upstate under Melissa Kelly.
Yeah. So can we talk about this for just a minute? I didn't realize, so I was looking at your bio getting ready to talk to you. I think this is a thing. It's a stereotypical thing I'm going to say, but it's a positive.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people I know who operate in Southern California, and I'm not asking your exact age, but you seem younger than you must be.
Yeah.
Because you're dressed casually. You've got, you know, always have a little color in your face.
Yeah.
You seem kind of chill.
Yeah.
And then I went and looked up, like, who you'd work for. And you've worked for, like, a lot of people who are sort of in the, like, icon stuff. Like, Larry Fulgione is, like, I was stunned to read that you had worked for Larry for a while.
Yeah.
Including at American Place, which was the landmark
restaurant
that he opened in 83 in New York City.
Yeah. I mean, like, from the very beginning in my career, I always felt like I always wanted to work for distinguished people.
Yeah.
Like I always wanted to work with the best. You uh-huh. know, like whoever that happened to be, and at that time, like when I started cooking late 80s, you know, there wasn't a lot of ways to like get information about who's doing what. I mean, you had Gourmet magazine, you had Bon Appetit, you had
New York Times.
Yeah. You had like there was, you know, it was a much different media world. Like nowadays, like you'll hear about kids doing pop-ups like in
yes.
Silver Lake.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like yeah. and people will be covering it extensively.
Or Mexico City.
Right. So it's like, you know, but the landscape has changed so much. So, you know, I remember one time, I think it was maybe Food Arts and Larry was on the cover. Might have been even Food and Wine. He was holding the chicken.
Okay.
And I saw that picture of him at the. I was working at a little restaurant in New Hope, Pennsylvania, which is where I really uh-huh. kind of started. And you
not
know,
the Cuttaloosa Inn.
Yeah. No, at a place called the Forger House.
Okay.
Which was a great little restaurant. The guy. I mean, I still am in touch with the chef.
That's
that
great.
Owned that place. He now has a place down in North Carolina. But, and I remember seeing that magazine on his desk with Larry on the front cover, and I said, you know, like that's the guy I want to work for. So I applied. You know, when I went to cooking school and we had, you know, you have to do your externship at CIA. Mm-hmm. So I applied to Larry. I applied with Alice Waters. Mm-hmm. I applied with Wolfgang Puck.
Mm-hmm.
I applied with Jimmy Schmidt, who yeah. was, I believe, at the Rattlesnake Club.
Which was actually co-owned with Michael McCarty.
Yeah.
Michael Santa Monica.
Right. So, I mean, you know, I at that moment in time, those people were, you know, sort of like on the cutting edge of American cuisine. And that's, so I, you know, those are the type of people that I always wanted to work for right from the beginning of my career.
Interesting. So was it for you, it's funny because on the same show, I just interviewed her about an hour and a half ago, Della Gossett
yeah.
was saying that she was a career changer. Because mm. I said, wow, you know, you work for Charlie Trotter and then you go to Wolfgang Puck. Mm. And she said, well, I started late and I decided if I was going to do this, I wanted to work for the best.
Right.
Right. Mm. When you say it, though, was it for you because you wanted to learn from the best? Was it that you wanted the challenge of proving yourself in those environments that were probably the most demanding at the time? Mm. What was the driver for that desire?
I think because, you know, my father is a mentor to me, you mm-hmm. know, and like a role model, and he was very successful in completely unrelated field. And I kind of, I think like a lot of people, like I, you know, I really felt like if I was going to be a cook
yeah.
and I was going to commit myself to it, it was going to have to be like, I wanted it to be a, you know, somewhat distinguished career.
Yeah.
I felt like the only way I'd be able to achieve that was by working for people that had already reached that level.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I felt like,
So you felt like in all ways, so like their mentorship, the what you would see and absorb,
right, their ability,
like on all yeah. levels, it would just imbue you with sort of the best
yeah I think
possibility
I mean,
of getting there yourself or to a place like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think like what I learned, you know, the one thing that I learned from my father is that like you need to, you know, if you want to achieve in any field
yeah.
like you've got to be around the best
yes.
minds, the best
yes.
thinkers, the
yes.
best, you know, and I mean, in our case, it, you know, the best craftsmen or the best artists, you know, those are the type of people that, you know, that will, you know, give you the knowledge that you need
mm-hmm.
or the inspiration that you need in order to become successful. And so that,
yes.
I think that's why I gravitated towards people that, you know, that, you know, are agreed upon to be sort of like, you know, the leaders of this field.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, when I left working for Larry and went to New York, like I really wanted to, you know, I mean, I applied to only 4-star places. Like, you know, I applied to Boulay, I applied to Le Bernardin, I applied to Le Cirque.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was those are the type of people I always wanted to be working with and
yeah.
for. Because
yeah.
I also think I knew I needed it. Like, I needed a, you know.
You needed to be challenged in that way?
Needed to be challenged. Like,
yeah.
I, you know.
Did you have an, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I never wanted to be like a, you know.
Journeyman?
Yeah, or a middle of the road kind yeah. of person. Like, I wanted to, if I was going to do this, like, I wanted to do it really well.
Yeah. So you, well, first of all, what brought you out here?
Wolfgang Puck.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
I had worked, you know, I worked in New York for several years at Le Cirque, and then they opened a new restaurant, and it was called Osteria del Cerco, and
mm-hmm.
I was one of the opening chefs at Cerco. And then.
That was the Sons, wasn't
yeah.
it? Yeah.
Mauro and Mario
yeah.
and Marco.
Yeah.
And I was the chef along with. Alessandro Giuntoli, who is actually one of Sirio's nephews.
Okay.
Italian.
Okay.
Born. And And we kind of ran that place together. And then I just decided like I needed a change, and my wife and I thought maybe we needed to get out of New York.
Mm-hmm.
My wife was a pastry chef and worked at, she was a pastry chef at Zoe in New York.
Oh, sure.
She was a pastry chef at Topeka with David Walzog.
Sure, I just saw David in Vegas back in October. We had lunch together. Yeah.
And we, you know, we kind of decided like maybe we want to start a family.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, maybe New York's not the right place to do it. And so I applied to, again, I applied to Wolfgang. I applied with, I believe I applied with Jeremiah Tower. I applied with Alice Waters. And, you know, the first guy that got back to me was Wolfgang. He said, why don't you come out? Like,
personally.
I'll put you on a plane. You come out. You cook with me for a couple of days, and we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
And then I did. And, you know, I remember we did a couple of private. We did one night we did like a private party. It was just me and Wolf cooking.
Yeah.
And maybe one or two other cooks. And that was a lot of fun. And it was also like completely different.
Yeah.
Than anything I'd ever done, because, you know, with Larry, we're cooking obviously very like American regional food. You know, I trained at the CIA, and then I trained at Le Cirque, and I trained in France. So everything after I left Larry was like just very rigorous French technique,
yes.
French food,
yeah.
And to, you know, to come out here and then, you know, and work with Wolfgang. I remember he cooked one of the dishes that we cooked. I'll never forget. Was like we had a live king crab, and he hacked the thing to pieces and then cooked it in a black bean sauce, like a Chinese.
Was this a Chinois?
Black bean sauce. No, it was at Spago.
At Spago.
The original Spago on
Green
Avenue.
Yeah.
So, and I was thinking, like, I had never seen anything like that. I'd never eaten that, you know. I know it's very, you know, it's a fairly common dish if you go to a Chinese seafood restaurant.
Yeah.
But for him, you know, to see Wolf doing it with a live king crab and making this delicious, like, black bean sauce with king crab was completely different for me. Never saw anything like it.
But did you connect with him on a certain level? Because that sounds very casual and spontaneous and primal, right?
Yeah.
But he had training. He had some serious freaking training. This is the thing I think so many people don't get about Wolfgang Puck is he came up in 3-star Michelin restaurants.
Yeah. No, Wolf's.
And then came over here and, you know, had this vision of doing this stripped down food, but with the amazing. I mean, he's just sort of a once in a generation talent, you know.
And I mean, and he's achieved more than probably any other chef in the world, I would think.
From a business standpoint.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, you know what I mean?
But
he also has that foundation.
He has chops.
Yeah.
No, he definitely has chops. I mean, he's an excellent cook. He knows, he's a very instinctual cook.
Yes.
He was an inspiration to me. He might not have been at Spago every day, but he was working every day.
Yeah.
He worked his ass off, and everybody around him worked their ass off. And he's inspirational. I never heard him raise his voice. Honestly, never really saw him angry. Like
there's people in that company who've been there for 40 years.
Yeah. And he treats people well, and he understands that if he wants to keep good people around him, he needs to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, for me, I spent about a year working with Wolf, and, you know, it was right at the time when Spago Beverly Hills was about to open.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for a while there, at the very beginning, it was, Wolf was always around, Lee Hefter was always around. Mm-hmm. There was a big team around because they kind of was gathering sort of like talent, I guess you would say.
That was going to disperse, but had it yet.
Exactly.
Right.
And so there was, when I first got there, there was tons of people around always. You know?
Yeah.
Francois was around still, Francois mm-hmm. Kwaku Dongo.
Okay.
Wolf, Lee, this guy Matt Benchavenga, who
he passed away a couple years ago. Yeah,
great guy. He was around. Thomas Boyce was around. He wound up going up to Portland, married to Kim Boyce.
Mm-hmm.
All sorts of people.
Yeah.
And then once Spago Beverly Hills opened, then the team kind of broke up, and I stayed on as the chef de cuisine at the original Spago.
Yeah.
And I did that for about a year, and I loved it. You know, I mean, I had pretty much free reign. You know, every once in a while somebody would come and tell you, hey, your food costs a little high.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, maybe I won't buy as many truffles this week or this month, you know. But that was pretty much, other than that, like, I could just do what I wanted to do. And, you know, and I really, once, when I started doing that, like, when I was on my own there, I really started digging deep, like, back into, you know, all the French food that I cooked back in New York.
Yeah.
Because that's just like, that was my comfort zone, I guess
you realize
would say.
That's kind of who you were as a chef.
And I really started cooking a lot like that. And then, my wife was taking a class at UCLA Extension,
mm-hmm.
and wound up being in a class where Jeff King, who's the owner of the Water Grill,
mm-hmm.
was speaking, and
okay.
met him. Like, really, he was a great guy. I don't know if you ever met him, but
no,
great guy. Like, just one of those people that kind of like draws people in. Mm-hmm. And my wife absolutely loved him and talked to him after the class, and you know, said that, you know, I'm a pastry chef, because my wife was a pastry for Wolfgang for 2.5 years. She mm-hmm. she was the pastry chef at Aubergine and Beverly Hills, and then they also had one in Seattle and mm-hmm. one in Arizona somewhere.
Okay.
And she ran all three of those
yeah.
pastry departments, and she helped open Shinhwa in Vegas. And she said, you know, my husband's a chef and this and that. And he gave her a card and said, well, if you ever need anything, let me know. And then, you know, I found out that there was this restaurant called the Water Girl downtown that was looking for a chef. And I was like, that might be interesting. So I applied for the job and through Jeff, called him from the business card that I had and said, well, why don't you send a resume and we'll see what happens. And then, you know, I interviewed, I cooked for him a couple times, and then eventually got the job. So mm-hmm. I left Wolf after about a year. And started the Water Girl for 7 years.
So what? Providence to me is such a singular restaurant out here.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're talking about fine dining in L.A.,
yeah,
they're almost mutually exclusive, right?
Yeah.
But you've managed to pull it off,
right?
Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
What made you want to do a place like that here? And B, how have you threaded that needle?
Yeah,
how have you made it work in this setting where people don't like to generally get dressed up?
Yeah.
Don't, you know, everything's casual. You know, whenever I pack to come out here, I always have this moment where I have a dialogue with myself where I go, is this going to be okay to wear to whatever X? Mm. And then I go, yeah, it is. It's LA. It's fine.
Right.
You know, and it always is.
Right. I mean, for me, like, I always knew that restaurant would be what it is. Like, you know,
you had a vision, you had a real strong vision for it.
I really feel like it was all I ever knew. Like, I only ever worked in fine dining restaurants.
Right.
You know, I never worked any, you know, I mean, probably the most casual place I ever worked was an American place.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe the Beekman 1766 Tavern.
Right.
So like, you know, I felt like that's what I'd been preparing for my whole career for 15 years leading up to that. So, I think that's what it was always going to be, because I didn't know anything else. I didn't know what else
but how'd you make it fly here?
Well,
I mean, you're
one,
not even from here, like,
right?
Because sometimes people who are from here, like I think about somebody like Bruce Martyr,
well,
you know, and like he's like LA,
or
like,
Michael McCarty,
it's just
he's part of the DNA.
It's like in their blood,
yeah.
You know? They can feel it, but you didn't even have that benefit.
I didn't.
But when I came and ate there that first time, I was so it totally feels like it belongs right there. You know, it's perfect. To me, it was amazing. It's like one of the great meals I've had in the last 10 years, but definitely in terms of a meal in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It's and I'm not putting down other food. I'm just saying it's in a class by itself in that style of dining.
Yeah.
You know.
I feel like I had a leg up, you know. I mean, I kind of started to make a little bit of a name for myself at Water Girl,
yep.
And then, you know, and I was lucky enough to, you know, strike up a partnership with Donato, my
mm-hmm.
partner.
How'd you guys meet?
We met at Water Girl.
Okay.
He was hired to be a manager there. And, you know, like, right away, I was drawn to him. I was like, this guy, he approaches the front of the house like a back of the house employee. You know what I mean? He's workmanlike, roll up your sleeves.
Oh, I see what you mean.
You know, get shit done. But
no excuses.
Yeah, but all while wearing, you know, a Prada suit and you know, and
beautiful,
you know,
shoes.
And beautiful shoes and wearing a huge smile. Yeah. And, you know, and just... you know, I mean, he is, I mean, if there is a ledge, you know, if you're going to build like a Rushmore of like front of the house guys mm-hmm. in Los Angeles, it would be, you know, Piero Salvaggio, Donato.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably there's a couple of guys that have been through the ranks with Wolf.
Yes.
That would belong up there too.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Dargan and Johnny Romaglia.
Yeah.
Who, you know, just... You know, those, I mean, like Michael McCarty is another one, like the definition of hospitality, all those guys.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that definitely gave the restaurant a leg up. There's no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people still walk in the door every day and say, I'm a friend of Donato's. And, you know, like, and, you know, because all the years that he spent at Premi and with
Piero.
With Piero. And then, he opened Bastide with Alain Giraud.
Yeah.
And then, you know, went through, Ludo was a chef there for a while, and
uh-huh.
Walter Mansky was a chef there for a while. And then finally, you know, Joe Pitka still comes to the restaurant all the time. He was the owner of Bastide. And, you know, he got to know our then chef de cuisine. His name was Paul Shoemaker. And and then he hired Paul to be the chef of Bastide after he fired all the other guys. anyway, I mean, we sort of got off the track there, but
that's okay.
Know, but I feel like, you know, Providence was always going to be that. You know, it was always going to be fine dining. It was always going to be, you know, beautiful silver, beautiful china, beautiful glassware, a great wine list, a nice dining room, you know, a beautiful dining room, and a place that, you know, a place that I wanted it to feel like a refuge. And it didn't, you know, like a place where you could walk in and, you know, the world falls away and just come in and you focus on food and family and friends and whoever you're dining with. And, you know, I mean, to me, you know, as a kid, like growing up as a kid, I was lucky enough that my parents would take me out to nice restaurants and, you know, and it would have experiences like that. And food, so food was always very important in my life. And I, you know, I can still remember meals that I ate with my family when I was in my teens, you know, and, you know,
you can like run them down.
Yeah.
You run down all the food.
Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah. I'm the same way.
And, you know, and I wanted to have a restaurant where I could create, you know, memories like that for people. And that's why, that's how I, why I always knew that Providence would be what it is.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, and it, you know, continues to change. It continues to evolve.
Sure.
The food is very different than it was when we first opened, you know, but, you know, I always feel like, and I know Donato feels the same way, and so does the chef de cuisine, Tristan, who's Tristan Atchison, who's been there ever since we opened the doors, that our work, you know, our best work is still in front of us, you know? And I think that...
That's a big statement.
And I think, well, I think any good chef will tell you that.
Yeah.
You know
you
what
have
I mean?
To have that attitude,
you have
right?
to have that attitude.
The minute you... It sounds like a cliche, but the minute you don't, you're just... You start to coast.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, you just... You know, you know, I constantly, we're constantly pushing, constantly driving. And like, you know, now I feel like, I feel it as, it's as much a responsibility to our guests as it is to the people that are around, that, that surround me in the kitchen and in the front of the house. Like to constantly, you know, push them to create new experiences for them, to create new, you know, new challenges for them and to create, you know, to keep, you know, we keep pushing myself and all the chefs that are there to create, you know, a menu that is challenging, you know, for them, for our cooks to prepare, but also one, you know, where we don't forget that at the end of the day, our guests have to enjoy it too.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's really what I think keeps the restaurant fresh and, and evolving.
Are you personally excited about the Michelin Guide returning?
I am. I mean, I think,
did you feel dissed when they left?
You know, I didn't, not personally, like I didn't take it personally, but I did think that, you know, I just feel like, you know, LA is LA.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're a very opinionated city.
Yeah.
And I think we kind of get our hackles up pretty easily. And I think LA definitely got their hackles up about Michelin, about, you know, what they perceive to be slights or omissions, and made it known. You know, both. You know, and I'm talking about like not.
You mean
only
when the guide was here, people who didn't get a star? To
No. I don't think it didn't necessarily come from the chefs, but it definitely came from the media. And
I
think it also came from diners and stuff.
Yeah,
like a lot of, I think a lot of diners, and I think a lot of diners still have this opinion that, you know, well, LA doesn't need that. And we don't, you know, we don't need the Michelin Guide, and, you know,
I
and I think
felt that way about New York when they came.
Yeah, but, you know, but I think that's an easy sort of that's an easy kind of you know, answer to come up with if you're not a chef. But if you are a chef, and if you, you know, like, I mean, myself personally, you know, I remember when I left New York to go and work in France, I went because, you know, because I wanted to work in a Michelin star environment. And, you know, I remember what, like, when I made that decision, I can tell you the exact moment. I was sitting down. We were on our dinner break, and there were a lot of French cooks in the kitchen at Le Cirque, and there was this one guy in particular. His name was Christophe Megel, who now he works in Singapore. But anyway, he was showing me his CV, his resume, and I was looking at it, and I was like, and he happened to live in, he grew up in Strasbourg.
Okay.
So Strasbourg at the time, like per capita, had more Michelin stars than any other city in Europe.
Yeah.
You know, because you had Crocodile and Emile Young, and you had, you know, several other, three Michelin star restaurants in a tiny little village. And this guy had worked at all of them. And I was looking at his CV, and I was like, Jesus Christ, like, I need that. I need to have that on my resume.
Yeah.
And so I went home that night, and I told my wife, I'm like, look, we're not getting any younger, and we're going to have kids at some point. Like, we got to do this now. And we started making plans. And, you know, I talked to the chef de cuisine and the executive chefs at Le Cirque, and they got me hooked up, and I went. And I left a really good job at Le Cirque, too. You know, I was, I've been there several years, I've risen to saucier, and from there, the next step is sous chef.
Yeah.
And I left it, and I said, you know, I'm gonna go work for free.
Yes.
And you know, in France,
I'm going on a quest for knowledge.
Exactly. Because, yeah. You know,
that's
what you do.
Yeah.
And it's like so many other people that gone before me.
Yeah.
And so many people that have come after me.
Yes.
Like, you kids that are still doing that today.
Do you feel like you need to go over there? Do you feel like you need to cross an ocean to get that kind of that level of training still? Do you think you can get it as good here? Or do you think there's still a gap?
Now you can.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, when I went over there in 1994,
oh yeah,
I felt like there weren't many places I could go.
Yeah,
that would have benefited me more than where I was. You know what I mean?
Where would you go? I mean, there was Trotter.
Could have gone
maybe
there or something.
The laundry was only a year old.
Yeah,
I mean, like, where would you go with it at that time in this country?
But also, the thing was, is like, you know, like Michelin star restaurants, like the first one that I wound up working in was like, you know, you're talking about a restaurant that at the most. In the time that I was there, the most guests we ever served was 42.
Yeah.
And we had maybe a dozen cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah.
It's different.
Yeah.
You know, it's very different. And,
yeah.
You know, that level of detail, that level of execution, that level of craft is hard to find anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Not
at that time it was. Now you can find that. You know, you could go to Bennu, you could go to Cezanne, you could go to Manresa. You know,
yeah.
you have restaurants of a three Michelin star level in this country that are, you know, I believe every bit the equal of their European counterparts or Japanese counterparts or, you know, wherever the guide is printed.
What is the main thing about when you talk about training like that, right? Is the main thing technique or is it something else? Is it like kitchen organization or is it the whole experience?
It's
of those?
The whole experience.
Like you talk about Donato having that back of house attitude in the front of the house.
Yeah.
When I think of those great Michelin three-star restaurants of Europe, that's what I think of.
Right.
I feel like the minute you walk in the door, you're just like on a conveyor belt.
Yeah.
Like you're wanting for nothing.
Right. And that's exactly the way you should approach restaurants like that as a guest.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I'm here. I'm
right.
Here to
I'm
enjoy
yours.
The ride.
Here I right.
Yeah. What are we
right.
doing?
I'm you submitting.
Know? Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I feel like what it does for you as a, you know, as a young chef or a young cook is it shows you what's possible. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think it opens that door and reveals exactly what you could potentially achieve one day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To cook at a, you know, in a Michelin three-star restaurant, whether it's here or whether it's there or Japan or Spain or wherever, you know, I think what you see is like, you know, it's just such a dedication to craft and a dedication to hospitality,
mm-hmm.
a dedication to quality, you know, that it's very, you know, it's very, very difficult to achieve that level no matter where you are. And it's just something like if you're an aspirational chef, you know, it's fuel for the fire. You know what I mean?
Well, it's also isn't a lot of those places, obviously some of them are in major cities, right? But a lot of those places, they're like they're in a little country town.
Mm-hmm.
They're very often the only reason you would go to that town.
Right.
So they take on this even heightened sense of meaningfulness, you know. Like I don't know if you ever have. I once saw David Kinch speak talking about Alain Chappelle.
Yeah,
and the way he told this story, it was like he was driving out there and getting there. And then there's a dish he described, I think with peas and lamb, and but it's like, I mean, he describes it like a great writer. It's unbelievable how indelible this moment was for him.
Yeah,
well, but I think there's something about them, these places being kind of removed from almost everything else, you know.
Mm.
You know, people talk about the it's not around, like the journey that people would make to El Bulli.
Yeah,
you know, but that's very typical of a lot of those restaurants.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like I remember the first time I went to Michel Bras, you know, and I had, I mean, I bought his first book, like I think it was 1990 or 1991, mm-hmm. the Le Livre de Michel Bras, which now if you can find, it's going to cost you $1,200.
Mm-hmm.
That book. You know, so I mean, I had mythologized this guy in my head for, you know, 20 plus years.
Yeah.
And when I finally went, I took my two kids with me and my wife. You know, we were all, you know, I mean, I felt that, you know, like driving up to, you know, he's in La Giola in the
mm-hmm.
Albrac, you know, like driving up there, you know, it's up this, you know, mountain pass and you've got the typical cows up there in the fields on either side of the road. And you drive up to what is, you know, the restaurant. It's just, it's stunning, like incredible. Like, you know, and we stayed there for the night and, you know, like just, I just remember it being absolutely amazing, you know. And I remember it being like very, very hot in the valley. By the time we got up to where the restaurant was, it had gotten cold, you know, and we checked in, we settled into our rooms. And then we met the kids out back behind the rooms that we were staying in, and there was like, you know, just this incredible view over what is called the Massif Central in France there, and you know, mountains in the background, and you know, cows sort of like walking around in the field right behind the place. Just it was absolutely magical.
I guess that's the word I'm looking for. It's heightened.
Yeah, but also it's
everything
like,
you're describing, it just like it heightens all your senses. It makes it all just seem almost like dreamlike.
It is. And then, you know, I remember we checked into the hotel and we're like, well, we have reservations for dinner. What time should we come down? And like, you know, we're open from 7 till 10 or 7 till 9. Come when you like.
Because it was basically your table for the night.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's, you know, like, you get there. Yeah. You know, I remember we check into the front desk. They bring us into the lounge. You know, they start to bring us amuse-bouche and the wine list and the menu. And, you know, we can talk about the wine list. We can talk about the menu now. And then, you know, whenever you're ready, we'll go into, you know, we'll go in and get you seated for dinner. It's just, it's magical. It's special. It's different. It's something that, you know, there are very few places in the world when you can experience that level of hospitality. And, you know, and it takes years and years and years and years to get to that point. I mean, even like, I mean, you mentioned El Bulli. Like, El Bulli was not anything like what it wound up being.
No.
You know, it was a humble little restaurant perched on the side of a cliff.
I mean, now you would point to something like Osteria Francescana, you know, and Massimo Bottura will tell you when he first opened it, people were screaming sacrilege.
Yeah.
Because he was, you know, bastardizing classic Italian food.
Of course, yeah. I mean, he was ostracized.
That was not an instant hit.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, Patrick O'Connell, same thing. I mean, you were at the Beard Awards. You saw that package they put together for him for the Inn of Washington.
Yeah, I chatted with him right after. He's on such a high right now.
I mean, now he's a 3 Michelin star chef. When he opened 40 years ago, he was charging $4.95 for dinner.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was basically a diner
in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, I'm insane. About to go there for the first time ever.
Have you been? I'm sure it's going to be amazing. No, but I've been hearing stories of it all my life because my aunt and uncle both live in D.C.
Okay.
And live in Bethesda. And so they would go, you know, they
special occasions.
Go there for special occasions. For 30 years they've been going there.
But even, you know, I knew, you know, more or less where it is. But, I've now actually had to plan the trip, right?
Yeah,
so it really makes that Michelin line.
Worth the journey.
It's literally, because, I'm taking a train to D.C. And then it's like almost like a two-hour adventure after that.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I mean, I'm going to stay there. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
I mean, we did the same thing. I remember on this same trip we went to Michel Bralik, one of the other chefs that I absolutely have idolized, like my entire career is oh my god, Olivier Rollinger.
Okay.
And you know, we went to his restaurant on that trip too, and we stayed there. I mean, oh my god, what an incredible place. Like, I mean, it's just the most beautiful, like, seaside country manor that was just like, you know, just so incredibly pristine. I remember my wife and I, we checked in, and, you know, Olivier Rollinger, his food was very much about spices.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously incredible seafood, but also spices. And and the reason for that is because Brittany, you know, in the area where he is, was always a stop on the route in the spice trade.
Yeah.
And so spice is very important to that region and very important to him. So all the rooms in this manor are named after spices.
Oh,
so
great.
We stayed in the ginger room, and of course there's like ginger on the, like candied ginger for you to enjoy when you get to the room. Our kids were staying in the, I think it was Cinnamon was the name of the room.
Okay.
But I remember my wife and I, we checked in and put our stuff away, like pushed the curtains aside to look out onto the bay.
Yeah.
And there's these two little girls down there in the field, like right below our window. And they're like in these country dresses. Like, and my wife and I were thinking to ourselves, like, this is just, it's like a fucking postcard. They must have staged this.
Right.
You know? It just couldn't be happening this way. But it was like, you know, that's the magic that places like that provide.
Yeah.
And, it's a unique thing.
And it changes you.
Yeah.
As even a diner or someone observes your industry. I remember years ago I wrote a book about the Bocuse d'Or, and I spent a bunch of time around the French Laundry. It was the year Tim Hollingsworth competed. Yeah. And, you know, I'd never eaten at the French Laundry. I got to eat there a few times. I got to eat at Danielle.
Mm.
You know, places I just hadn't splurged on.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to my agent at the time, I said, you know, David, when you eat meals at these places, it changes you.
Yeah.
And he said, he made a joke, like, yeah, you gain weight. I said, no, 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 it really changes you. Your understanding of real hospitality, like you said, what's possible.
Right.
Your understanding of what the food can be. You know, like
Well, I fully believe that the French Laundry is that same type of magical place.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Like, I mean, having seen it, like, I mean, you know, I'm lucky enough to consider Thomas a friend, and you know, and I've been there. He hosts these dinners every once in a while for chefs, fellow chefs, and you know, I've been lucky enough to go a few times, and like what that restaurant has become, especially after the renovation, is that, I mean, it is the prototype for what a restaurant could be in terms of, you know, limiting the carbon footprint that the restaurant has, you know, all the work that he's done, I mean, geothermal heating and cooling, and, you know, he's got...
Well, and then, like, the farm, solar the power. Farm across the road. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just crazy.
Yeah, he's got solar power there in the restaurant. Like, it's ridiculous. It's incredible. Yeah. Like, every aspect of it is incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, we this past year, I was there for a dinner, and we sat in this new private room that they built around this big circular table, which is just... I mean, it's one of the most beautiful tables I've ever sat at. Yeah. And then to be able to sit at it with Thomas and with, you know, with other chefs that I respect and admire, and to be able to be there in their company makes, you know, made that meal all the more special. Mm-hmm. But the fact that Thomas, like, in all of his success and all of his... all the, you know, accolades and adulation that he receives on a daily basis, mm-hmm. to be, you know, to still want to get a group of his, you know, colleagues to sit around him and just talk and discuss and, mm-hmm. you know, what, you know, what's going on in your place, mm-hmm. you know, what are the challenges that you're facing is incredible. You know what I mean? Like, to me, for somebody of that stature to, you know, to put these events together, to bring people together, just sit and talk, honestly, is incredible. And I remember at one point in the meal, he was sitting there and he was talking about when he was a kid and he was coming up and just starting to make a name for himself. And the chef that at that moment that everyone in the country really idolized was Jean-Louis Paladin,
mm-hmm.
from the Watergate Hotel in D.C. And he remembered the first time that he was actually able to, like, meet him and sit down with him and, you know, enjoy a meal together. And the feeling they had and the thought that was going through his head, like, Jesus Christ, here I am. And I'm, this guy is everything to me. Yes. And here I am. And we're sitting and we're enjoying a meal together. And I know every chef at that table, along, you know, including myself, was thinking exactly that same thing about Thomas at that moment as he was telling that story.
He does seem to get and cherish his place in the industry. You know, he... I don't know if he still does it, but I know he used to mail... Like, if people got nominated for beers, he would mail a typed, personally signed letter.
I've got everyone that he ever sent me.
Yeah, yeah. I asked him once on the record, I said... Did you want this position of leadership? You know, and he said, "Yeah, just very matter-of-factly." I think he likes to be able.
Well,
to,
you just don't.
He
don't,
loves to be able to do that.
Yeah, but you don't wind up where he is by accident.
No,
you know what I mean.
Him, yeah, I mean, of all people, I don't know a more methodical. Mm-hmm.
He is,
you know, nothing left to chance person.
Yeah, he's absolutely an inspiration, and that's why he's achieved what he's achieved, and is able to open restaurants like all across the country. I mean, now he's just opened a tack room.
And
he's got the
and at sea now, and at sea.
Yeah, I mean, it's
he's on Seaborn now.
Yeah, it's remarkable. You know.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm gonna let you go get some lunch.
All right.
Thanks.
Pleasure talking.
Thanks
to you.
For sitting and chatting.
It's a, really
a
real pleasure.
It. Thank you.
I'm glad that we had the chance to do it.
Me too.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right, man.
This episode is brought to you by Foster Sundry, a specialty grocery located in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Since opening in August 2015, Foster Sundry has evolved into a neighborhood hub for weekend brunch, weeknight groceries, coffee on your morning commute, a draft beer after work, and so much more. Their cheese counter, whole animal butcher, and produce section make grocery shopping a pleasure. Foster Sundry also offers catering and wholesale. Learn more at fostersundry.com. That's FOSTERSUNDRY.com.
I hope you're enjoying this podcast. And you know, Heritage Radio Network has thousands more. Hi, my name is Linda Pelagio, and I'm the host on A Taste of the Past here on HRN. Join us on a weekly journey through culinary history, where we explore the when, where, what, and why of food throughout history. You can find A Taste of the Past wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to get you to our next interviews immediately. I'm not going to do any more promotion. We don't have time. We're going to get right to the next interview. Laura Avery. Caitlin, you know of my love and of other people's love for the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
Yes.
Okay. So Laura Avery was the director of that market since 1982, a year after it was created.
Wow.
She's largely credited with making it into what it was. I mean, no single person really ever is responsible for something like that, but she is kind of credited with all that. And I really wanted to talk to her. She was speaking at this panel. I've known her name forever. I've never met her. And she suggested that Meredith Bell, who is a newish farmer, a newishly minted farmer, a career switcher who instead of going into a kitchen went into the farming world, crash-coursed herself on how to do that and did it. And we sat down during the lunchtime at the conference, again, outside. The three of us had a lovely chat, and I literally don't think I need to say another word about it. I'm going to kick it right over to my interview with Laura Avery and Meredith Bell, both of whom I was meeting for the first time and both of whom I hope to see again in the future. Here you go. Why don't you, Laura, tell me how the three of us ended being here and together? Because I had written to you. You recently retired from you seem too modest. Maybe you're not. You've had half a beer, so maybe you'll pat yourself on the back. But I was going to say you've recently retired from an illustrious career with the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
Right.
You're largely seen as the person who made that market.
Well,
what
you know,
it is.
I'm the only person who actually ran that market from a year after it started.
Yes.
It started in 1981. I came on board in 1982 when there really wasn't a job description for a farmer's market manager.
Yeah.
It was just kind of like the city manager of the city of Santa Monica needed someone to go out there on Wednesdays and tell the farmers where to park.
Make sure all hell didn't, make sure it wasn't pandemonium.
Yeah. And I started in, it just seemed like a really good, fun thing to do. I was a stay-at-home mom. I had an 18-month-old and a 2-month-old, and I was ready to get out of the house. It was a one-day-a-week job when it started.
Now,
so
had
it
you
was a
done,
great job.
Had you done jobs that had the same sort of a skill? Like, had you ever done theater? Had you ever been involved in film production, like even in school?
Are you saying that a farmer's market is like theater?
I think like a restaurant, it is like a production.
Like a production,
yes.
Right.
Is it not?
I think in a lot of ways it is. It's kind of just a lot of coordinating where people park.
Yes.
And then what I did in my very early days when I was learning about the farmer's market, there was a very minimal sort of a set of regulations that came out from CDFA, California Department of Food and Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no real manual for how to operate a farmer's market. So I figured if I'm going to be out here supervising about, when I started there were 45 farmers on Arizona Avenue, I just need to get to know who you are and can we talk and can I get to know you? So I kind of spent my first year just talking to farmers and finding out from their perspective what a farmer's market was.
And what would make it work?
Yeah, what makes it work for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're
so
the ones that are there bringing all the produce and basically paying my salary because they're charged a percentage for their booth. So, yeah.
Okay.
What's this for you?
Well, I have to say, we don't know each other before last night. We just met yesterday and
yeah,
a couple of emails last week. But that's the beer talking. But,
no, it's not.
You know, so I'm. This isn't me flattering a friend. That I think this market is largely considered, if not the best, one of the very best farmers markets in this country, maybe in the world. I love going there. I'm flying home this Wednesday. I'm taking a friend who's never been to the market for a coffee and something to eat that morning before I head to the airport.
I can give you some hot tips on what to get.
I will do that off
all
the
right,
air.
Great.
Thank you. But before we get too deep into that, of all the farmers that you've known over the years, I wrote asking for a sit down while we were here at this conference, and you said, I'm copying Meredith. She has some ideas too. So of all the farmers in the city of or the greater Los Angeles area, what was it about Meredith that you wanted her to be part of this conversation?
Well, she and I were talking on a panel today together, and she's kind of one of my newer farmer acquaintances. She started the market, she'll tell you
she's
exactly.
A newish farmer.
Newish. Yeah,
newish.
She is.
Newish.
And
last 7 years?
Five.
Okay.
5 years at the market, yeah. But I just feel like her story is unique and that kind of does charts a trajectory for someone who kind of started at new in farming all the way through being at the farmer's market and then sort of plotting the way forward.
Got it. So we're in a limited, you guys have a thing to get to. This is like, it's one thing after another, panel today.
Yeah.
But so the short version of your story, you were in the catering business?
So I was in fashion and then in New York City and got out of the fashion industry.
What were you doing in fashion?
I was doing operations for a high-end luxury purse company.
operations is in production?
As in store operations.
Store operations.
Yep,
so they had their own retail.
Yep.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, and moved to San Diego, and you know, there's no fashion or high-end luxury brands there, and so got into food and beverage and food and beverage operations. It seemed to make sense. And the longer I stayed in it, you know, I got into sales and then realized that the life that I was living and what I supported personally was not what I was selling. And I just got to a point where I couldn't do it anymore. I felt jaded and I felt like, you know, what am I doing to impact society and what am I doing to help other people and make myself better at the same point? So threw in the towel and said, that's it. I'm either going to go back to grad school and get into public policy or education, or I'm going to start a farm. And
now, here again, was there similar question I asked Laura. Was there anything in your background, advocacy work, idealism? Did you like to read Ayn Rand books as a kid? Like,
it literally was just my passion of food. Had never farmed a day in my life. Okay. My dad worked for an oil company.
Okay.
You know, in computers.
Okay.
They thought I was certifiably crazy.
You decided you were going to do a farm?
When I was going to farm, yeah.
Okay, so how does one, it sounds like a bad Matt Damon movie. Like, how do you start a farm?
You know, I mean, literally, I just tell people, as I started to think about it more, I started to, you know, watch some documentaries and read some books, but it didn't make sense until I finally just said, I'm going to do it. And I'm just going to stop and go all in and put one foot in front of the other and just figure it out as I go. And I think, you know, because my background isn't in farming, I obviously have had a lot larger learning curve.
Yes.
And it's taken me a long time to figure out what my path exactly is within farming. Mm-hmm. But I think I also, because I haven't been farming, I also bring an outsider's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think of things, I think, a little bit differently than the traditional farmer. And so I think that's, you know, my story resonates with people because of that. And I think people see it as maybe idealist. And I think of it as like, I'm just doing what I feel like I should be doing in this world.
It's like, this happens a lot on this show. There's a lot of cliches uttered on this show, but they're all true, right? You're following your bliss,
right,
as some people might put it, or your joy, or your, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, it's one of those funny things, right? Like, I started farming because I wanted to do it for myself. Like, selfishly, I was like, this is what's going to make me happy.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's... you know, what the people have brought to me that has made me happy. It's not actually the farming itself. It's the fact that I get to talk to people every day that are telling me about, you know, their health issues that they've had and how they've overcome them, or how they're, you know, have been more passionate about food now than they have ever been before. And, you know, now they're educating themselves and their kids, and, you know, their kids are going to be the ones that are controlling the food system when we get older. And I want to make sure that they're set up properly.
So, is this right? It's produce and also livestock?
So, yeah, that's why I said it's been a twisty kind of turn for me. So I started off with produce, went into beef, got into some pork and lamb, and about 18 months ago, I had a famous chef that stumbled across our chickens at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. And it was funny because when I started that market, one of the market managers said to me, this market will change your life. And I kind of like was like, OK, you know, like I didn't really know. I mean, I knew I wanted to get into the market and that was always a goal for me. But I had no clue how it was truly, sincerely going to change my life.
Can I interrupt for 1 second?
Yeah.
Because I just don't want to lose the moment. So is this a wait list situation to get into the market?
I was going
to
say the reason Meredith got in is I had a beef farmer.
Yeah.
I'd been trying to recruit grass-fed, grass-finished, local, sustainably grown beef. And I had one from Lompoc.
Yeah.
The drought came in 2015.
Yeah.
And she literally called me. She said, look, I have a 15,000-acre land grant ranch. There's not a blade of grass for my cattle. For the first time in 200 years or 100 years, I've got to ship all my cattle to Northern California. I have to drop out of the market. So I had an opening for beef. So I knew Meredith had beef. So I called me. I said, hey, I got a beef opening. And so she came in and she started. It was
temporary.
If it had been chickens,
temporary,
she wouldn't have gotten in. But it was beef.
Right.
Because I have chicken all over the place. But I had no.
But I mean, yeah, it is. And I think when I came into the market, people were like, one, who are you? Two, you just barely started farming. How did you get into this market? Because there's a 7-year wait list.
Seven years, that's the estimate.
No, I mean, that's what people say. Yeah. People think it goes.
Well, like, how many people, like, how many farms are on that list, roughly?
Well, you know, people apply every year, and we scan and save the applications, and then we tell them we'll call you if we need you, and if you don't hear from us, just send us your updated information next year. So we don't. It's not prioritized into like you are next on the list.
It's more about something like this, where there was a need for beef.
I'm not going to put a strawberry person in because I needed beef. So luckily, it was meant to be.
It was meant to be. Yeah, and I think, too, we have to remember that the aging demographic of the farmer is getting older, right? And I'm not young by any means, but I'm definitely younger. And so I think for long-term perspective, you have to look at those younger generations of farmers that are coming in, because that's who's going to carry and sustain these farmers mm-hmm. markets, because inevitably all these people that have been in the market for 20 years are going to want to retire at some point. And then mm-hmm. who's going to carry on that tradition?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
how do you open a door to a new farmer? You know, I mean, is somebody's got to retire or decease
yes.
or be kicked out for cheating? And so, because people don't necessarily say, I've had enough of this. Once people are in that market, it's their livelihood and they tend to stay.
Yeah. I mean, for me coming from New York, this is like the way people are with New York City apartments, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the old joke that people used to scan the obituaries.
Farmer's market control.
And then they would scan the obituaries and then, like, see how to find the listings, you know? That's that's true.
Yeah.
That's a real thing.
Well, we have four markets in Santa Monica, and what we try to do is direct a farmer to one of our other markets and assure them that if you go to that market and if you really are going to engage with the customers, Ben Hyman, who is the farmer from Fisherman, Wild Local Seafood, we put him out at our Pico Saturday Farmers Market mm-hmm. right at the entrance of the market.
Mm-hmm.
Not one person walked by his booth without him introducing himself and talking about seafood. He immediately became very successful in his booth at the Pico Farmers Market with fish
mm-hmm.
because of his mad customer service
Got
skills.
It. So what makes that market, what makes the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market, other than the fact it's in Santa Monica, other than the fact on the right day you can hear the waves crashing on the shore, right? We're just
almost.
You can convince yourself you can hear them. Right. In my memory, I hear them when I'm there. I'll check it on Wednesday.
Yeah.
But beyond all that, what is it? Well, what is so special about that market?
I think what's interesting is Santa Monica is on a Wednesday.
Yes.
Most of the markets in LA are on Saturday or Sunday.
For I call civilians. Like for non-industry.
Yes, but people who, let's say the restaurant trade. So they shop for the weekend, they load up for the weekend, and then on Tuesday they're out of everything.
Okay.
So they need to replenish on Wednesday for the weekend,
yes.
and they need a big variety of produce. And Santa Monica, we average now about 75 farmers a week. It's all seasonal, obviously.
Yeah.
And we also get the actual farmer coming to the market.
Okay.
A lot of the markets on the weekends, they send employees, because a lot of farmers will do 5 or 6 markets on a weekend. Saturday and Sunday are the busiest market days for farms.
Yeah.
So when the farmer, him or herself, comes to the market, not only are they there and the customer gets all the absolute, you know, accurate information about the farm, the farmer is then able, somebody goes, oh, hey, say if I needed 6 cases of these, you know, next month or next week, or could you grow? The farmer can sit there and sort of like, you know, promise, you know, future, you know, deliveries to these people. Like, oh, yeah, if you're going to do this. And like Alex Weiser from Weiser Farms, he goes, it's like my showroom. I bring everything I grow, and then if people want a little more or something special, or can you just harvest it at this stage for me? Because I have... Yes, I can. Farmers there to say, yes, I can do that.
So are you out or are you easing out?
I'm out.
You are.
December 29th, 2018.
Because I was just going to say, you need to, I mean, I just met you, but you're still talking in the present tense.
Well, I shop at the market.
She's still there every Wednesday.
I come and shop.
Am I going to see you Wednesday morning?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, I'm not going to be there early.
Yeah.
I kind of tend to roll in about 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how hard was it for you to make this decision?
It was not hard.
Really?
It wasn't hard at all. I made the decision 18 months before my final day.
Okay.
In June of 2016.
And how long did you keep that to yourself? How long before you went public?
I didn't go public. I told my boss about a year out. I told my boss I was thinking about doing it.
Okay.
And that actually, I said my firm date is going to be December 2018.
Okay.
So he knew about a year out. And then we had a strategic planning session with the whole farmers market team about 8 months out.
Okay.
And at that meeting, I mean, we couldn't do a strategic plan without them knowing that I was not going to be there when this plan was like going to be taking effect. So I made the announcement then. I made it to the team, and I just sort of said, by the way, you know, December. And there was just this sort of like dead silence. Like, I don't think anybody, because I'd been there so long, anybody ever thought about, wait, you're leaving?
Right. What's the succession plan? Right.
This and that was our succession plan. Yeah. Like, now things are going to be, there will be a new person in this position. So. Yeah.
Did they bring someone in, or did they move someone up, or did they split your job into pieces?
No, my job stayed the same.
Yeah.
And we did a wide recruitment. Uh-huh. Staff did apply, you know, internal staff. Yeah. But the person that ultimately got hired was somebody who came from the Hollywood Farmers Market.
Okay.
Who was also on the LA Food Policy Council. Okay. Extensive food policy. A lot of what I do is I do a lot of networking outside the city with nonprofits like Food Forward, yes. LA Food Policy Council, okay. Farmer Veteran Coalition,
yeah.
Family Farmed out of Illinois. Yeah. I mean, organizations that are working on farming issues, food yes. farming issues, that sort of expand. Like, I always talk, looking over the parapet of the castle,
yeah.
like looking at the horizon, like what's out there and how can we extend our yeah. reach and our, you know, our relevance to the greater world. So we had someone that had a little bit more of like food policy
right.
and nonprofit experience. So, yeah. So she came on board, and actually she knew our staff already from yeah. her food policy work. So, yeah. So now it's what, we're now in May, and
yeah,
she's been there
are.
5 months, and I'm a happy retired person. Yeah, and right. my hashtag is now not my problem.
Is it really?
Not my,
it should be.
You know, no, I see, you know, issues that, you know, it's like, you know, we've got a whole team in yeah. place. They're all competent. They're all passionate, yeah. committed. So
my wife and I were the fundraisers at our kids' school in Brooklyn for 1 year. And mm. when the password on, we had created our
yeah.
role. We didn't want to do anything that was tied into the New York City public school system. So we created our own Gmail
hashtag,
account.
Oh,
no,
was?
An email account.
Yeah.
It was like fundraising, PS, whatever.
Okay.
But when we left, we changed the password to not our job anymore.
Right. Yeah.
And there's an auto. There's still to this day an auto reply message
That's
if
so
anybody
funny.
Tries to reach out to us, because that was. But see, but I have to go back to this question I asked you before. There was nothing in your path, because you seemed so, by all accounts, so suited to it. Even just hearing you talk about it right now.
Mm-hmm.
It makes, because I had done film production and marketing. My wife had done PR and worked at the TV Food Network. So we've always, like, you know, that job, it was a lot of events where we raised money, but we put our whole wedding together in an hour, literally.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I hope,
but there was
can...
nothing in your past that, like,
well,
could have predicted something like this?
I, you know, people have a gap year. I took a gap decade after
uh-huh.
I got out of college.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of traveling, and I had a lot of great adventures. And then by the time 10 years was almost up, it's like, I need to do something now that
yeah.
basically settle down, get married, have kids. And when you become a parent, when you're a young parent, you are now in a world where everything is like, you write your own rules and
yes.
you survive by your wits.
Yes.
So I thought, oh, a job where I can write my own rules and survive
yeah.
by my wits, this would be perfect. And that's kind of when this job came along, when my oldest daughter was 18 months old. I've been
so you
home
developed
for
a lot
months.
Of these skills as you went along.
There were no written rules for how to
yeah.
run a farmer's market when I
yeah.
started. You know,
yeah.
And luckily the city of Santa Monica, because it was such a community serving, public serving entity,
yes.
all it was just, you know, make it the best thing for everybody. And that was basically my mandate.
Was so, it?
I was just going to say, I think a lot of the success from like a farmer who had, I had shot the market before I started farming.
Sure.
And now being a farmer at the market, I think so much of the success of the market is due to Laura and her personality. And I don't think, you know, that's something that you're either born with and you're born to be an influencer and have presence about you. And we were literally just talking about this. Or you're,
yeah.
Yeah, or you're not.
Yeah.
And so much of that success of that market is because of who she is as a person
yeah.
And her passion. So,
and we should say this goes back to 82, correct?
82?
Yes.
October 1982.
Which also dovetails with, you know, a lot of things that were happening in food, you know, the whole chef and restaurant scene.
That hadn't really kicked off yet. I mean, I can, just from my personal anecdotal perspective at the
yeah.
farmer's market, I noticed chefs, you know, the farmers, everybody started noticing chefs like in the early 90s, mid-90s.
Not till then?
Not really till then. It really
wasn't.
What
about people like, what about like the Michaels crew?
Well, they were right next door, so
yeah,
they would come. I mean,
they
but
I know Nancy was early.
Nancy Silverton, and I huge props to Nancy Silverton. She was the first major chef who came
okay.
to the market shop and talked about it.
Okay.
And then they started kind of following her. And then by 1999, we had our first Chef Appreciation Day.
Okay.
We had this little ceremony in the middle of the market. We probably had 12 chefs
yeah.
who we forced to stop for like 1 minute to come and pick up their, now we got to go, we're shopping. So that started. And now today I'm going to say that we probably, I can't even count. I don't even know who a lot of them are. They just come in, they chef. And not only that, now the produce companies who come and pick up for them.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say, and we have a preferred parking area on all four ends of the market outside the market. And we issue parking permits. Okay. And we have meters, parking meters that are permanently posted with no parking, chefs only. And we give out about 70 permits a year.
Was it
for those spaces?
You know, when I think you said something a minute ago, like the city just wanted you to make it as good as possible. Was it because coming from New York, right? Anything that you're going to do in a public space, you got to just like gear up for basically enduring so much misery at all the municipal buildings. Is it different out here?
Well, the
it more pleasurable to go about this enterprise that you took on?
The only pushback we had was from the merchant retail community in downtown Santa Monica.
Okay.
But when the Santa Monica Wednesday Market opened, the Third Street Promenade back then was still called the Third Street Mall.
Yes.
And it consisted of basically, there was a Woolworths, there was a J.J. Newberry's, there were some radio shops, there were some TV shops, there was a lot of just funky old businesses. And when the farmers market moved in and we closed Arizona Avenue, a lot of them turned around and said, it's your fault we're not making any money because our customers can't park. So they literally sort of organized a protest, and they one time they tried to park their cars and prevent the farmers from driving in.
Wow.
But very soon after that, Santa Monica Place, the mall where we're sitting right now, opened, and that was the nail in the coffin of the Third Street Mall as a retail district.
Got
so that kind of just died off.
Yeah.
Santa Monica Place opened up, and then the market just kept continuing to double in volume every single year for the next 5 years. It just took off.
So I need to let you guys go in a minute as promised, as agreed. But Meredith, can you just talk about, you know, you talked about learning how to become a farmer, right?
Yeah.
What were your resources? Was it books? Was it, you know, not-for-profit organizations that were out there? Was it fellow farmers who would almost by definition maybe become your, you know, you'd become a competitor to?
Yep.
How did you get your bearings and jump into this?
A lot of it has just been through research and trial and error. I mean, it literally, I feel like every single day I fail multiple times and you learn from it, right?
Yeah.
And you pick yourself up and you say, okay, well, that's not going to work, so let's try this. And, you know, one of the things that I think I should have done that I didn't when I first started farming was find a better network of other farmers.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in Bakersfield, in my hometown, there's not a lot of small farmers. Everyone's large-scale conventional farming. And so finding somebody that was doing what I was doing wasn't necessarily an option.
Got it.
But any farmer...
Is this what we would call commercial farmers?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And anybody that, you know, asked me today, you know, that's the first thing I tell them, like, call me, contact me. I will prevent you from having those same failures that I had because I learned them the hard way. And if I can help somebody else get up off their feet and help to spread the word and educate consumers from my failures, like, I'm more than willing. And when you start talking to farmers, everyone is like that. Farming community is like that in general. And everybody wants other farmers to succeed.
Mm-hmm. They do.
Yeah.
So
honestly,
it's a very supportive. They don't see each other as threats.
No. I mean, there's more than enough business and more than enough customers for all of us.
Yeah.
And so the more that we help each other and help each other succeed and build each other up, the more that consumers see that. And then they tell their friends and they start posting it on social media and they start talking about it. And then they start demanding the restaurants and, you know, their local grocery stores to start looking at the smaller farmers. And so there's definitely, it's a community impact. It definitely takes everyone to be involved in it, but everyone has a voice and they have that option.
What I'm going to ask last question for both of you. What is, Meredith, and I'll start with you first, please. What is the thing, maybe the biggest surprise for you, however you want to come at it, the biggest surprise for you about farming when you got into it, or the thing you think people maybe least understand or most misunderstand about it?
You know, I think the thing that surprised me the most, and I think that's the most or the least talked about, is the regulation. You know, like when I started farming, I thought, oh, great, I'm going to put some vegetables in the row and I'm going to put water on them and make sure there's not weeds and then I'm going to sell them. But that's really not the way it works. I mean, you have to go through multiple government agencies. You have to go through USDA, CDFA, packing procedures, handling, health permit. Like,
and these things affect all stages?
All stages.
So to grow, to package, to sell.
Yep, all of it.
There's some kind of regulatory hurdle at each of those
steps. I tell people it's like
if you had to go to the DMV twice a week, every week of your life, that's what it's like to be a farmer, okay. right? Like, we're dealing with so many government agencies and yeah. permitting and all of these
state
things.
And federal?
State and federal. Well, yeah. My job is state and federal, okay. like what I do because of the ranching and yes. that livestock has to go through USDA, which is a federal. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that people don't think about as an obstacle. Everyone talks about, oh, the early hours and the long hours and the nature, mother nature and weather. And yeah, those are all things that you already know before you start farming.
Right. Yes. Those are things I know as a layperson.
But nobody yeah. talks about the local regulation and how to navigate it. And in my community, it was when I first started doing what I was doing, they yeah. didn't even know. I yeah. mean, they still don't. I'm dealing with them now. I'm building out a chicken processing facility at the farm. And it took 5 months for them to be able to get the paperwork and the information from the state and from the county to then be like, okay, now you can finally put in your permit. And so there's things like that you look at as a farmer and you're like, you know, like how many struggles we have on a daily basis just to grow food, and now you are adding another ridiculous amount of work, frustration, everything yes. where you just want to bang your head up against the wall sometimes and be like, why are you in my way? Just get out of my way.
Right.
Laura, same question.
So to me, I love talking to farmers.
Yeah.
And I've been there so long, and I've watched the market grow up. And what I keep hearing, I get some feedback sometimes that people are intimidated by the farmer's market, or they just don't know what to buy,
yeah.
or they get there and they're just like adrift, and they just don't know which direction to head. And,
yeah.
I just want to tell people, just start at the first booth and just say hello to a farmer and say, what have you got and what do you recommend and what's good? And I think
what do I do? A lot of farmers will tell you what to do with it.
Then there's that. So then you look at the
yeah.
person next
this
to
makes
you.
A great X.
Yep. And you say, oh, what are you buying that? What are you yeah. going to do with that?
Yes.
Are you over here? What are you going to get some of that? What would you do? And in 100% of the time, they're going to sit there and they're going to tell you
yes.
what they're doing with it. So I just think it's like, there's a huge variety there. It's crowded, it's busy, it's frenetic, and you just go in there and you just establish eye contact with a farmer.
Yes.
Or with somebody who's I've gone up to people with beautiful bags, wagons of produce, and I've said to them, what are you going to do with all that? And then that leads to a conversation, and it's
yeah.
led to invitations. Well, I'm having an opening at
yes.
the Museum of Jurassic Technology.
Right.
Why don't you come on down?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I just made a new friend. You just talk about the produce. That's really the way to overcome your initial trepidation.
It plays to
go.
Everyone's worst stereotypes of themselves and others, right? So, like, if you're like someone who lives in an urban setting, New York, LA, San Francisco,
yeah.
and someone's coming in from the sticks with their, what they've grown or raised or whatever, I think a lot of people make this mistaken assumption that there's this huge, when you say afraid to talk, I think as much, they mistakenly think they have to talk in some way other than
yeah.
the way they would normally talk.
Or they need to know something that they
or
that
they need
don't
to
know
something.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
they need to demonstrate.
Right.
It's like going into a stereo
mm-hmm.
store, if you don't know anything about all that stuff.
It's mm-hmm. intimidating.
It's intimidating.
Well, I know. I'm sure Meredith's face, your face lights up. If you get a customer coming up and going, what should I get?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, that's why we do what we do, is to be able to help people and show mm-hmm. them, like, here's what it is. And, like, here are all the different cuts you can actually
yes.
get. It's not just about ground beef or
yes.
boneless, skinless chicken breasts.
Yes.
Like, let me tell you, there's a whole other world out there.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, when you get the chance to educate somebody and teach them,
yes.
at the end of the day, they walk away and you're like, yes, that is exactly why I do what I do.
And yep. they'll be back.
You've
made a customer.
They'll be back.
Sometimes a friend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. All right. Well, on that note, thank you for your time. Did I stick the landing? Let me see.
You stuck the landing.
4 minutes late.
You're good.
Sorry.
Thank you so
You're
much.
Good.
Thank you. Great
Thanks.
To meet both of you.
Thanks.
Same
thank
here.
Thank you. And moving on to the last interview of this show, and also moving on quickly. Things move quickly here at the Friedman House. Caitlin and I, since introducing the last segment, have gone our separate ways. Caitlin had to head off into the city for work. That's how tight the schedule was this morning. So I, on my own, will introduce Chef Brooke Williamson. A lot of you may know Brooke from Top Chef, but she's been a fixture, even at the young age of her mid-30s, of the Los Angeles restaurant scene for years. She's worked at a number of prominent restaurants, including Michael's years ago. At Restaurant Zach's, she met her husband, who is now her co-chef and business partner, Nick Roberts, who I also met at the chef conference. And as I said at the top of the show, Brooke and I were just absolutely
wiped out at the end of day one of the conference. Excuse me, at the end of the day of the LA Chef Conference, kind of gave each other a look, and I said, maybe we should do this another time. She was very kind. She met me at the Santa Monica Farmers Market, appropriately enough, 2 days after the conference, and we found a bench looking out on the ocean, and that's where we did the interview. But Brooke, in addition to Top Chef, or I should say Top Chef is in addition to the rest of her career, she and Nick have Hudson House, The Triple, and Playa Provisions. I'm sure there'll be more to come in the future. I really enjoyed meeting her. I think you're going to enjoy hearing from her. And here you go, my chat with Chef Brooke Williamson. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, so we are at the, well, we're somewhere between the beach and the Santa Monica Farmers Market. We were both at the Chef Conference the other day.
Yes.
Our panels were the last panels up.
They both ran long, right?
They both went long. I had to do a book signing right after. I thought maybe you had even left because I didn't realize how long your panel went.
Yes.
And then I saw, it was like when an airplane arrives late, I saw all these people coming out of that direction. And you and I had, I think we looked at each other and we both knew right away we didn't want to.
You're like, I'm done.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's great.
Yes. Yeah. And then not having met before, we made a plan to do this today. I felt like it was going to happen. But
yeah, I'm pretty good at following through with my plans.
You never know. You never know. So thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, how did you find the, you know, that conference existed once before? This was the second year.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't here last year. I know this was a much bigger sort of iteration of it. The lineup was pretty great.
It was great, yeah.
Were you there for a good piece of the day? Did you get to take any of it in?
I was there probably the second half of the day. I got to see one full panel, walk around, have a couple of bites of fried chicken.
Yes.
But no, I mean, like, I think mostly I was there for my panel.
Yeah. Okay. So how many things like that do you do a year? Are you on panels, conferences? Like, are you on the circuit?
I mean, I'm on a circuit. I don't know if I'm on that circuit. I do a lot of traveling and events. I don't do a ton of speaking unless it's accompanied by a demo or something of that sort. But
do you not like it?
I don't love speaking in front of crowds. And sometimes I'm totally fine with it. I just kind of never know how I'm going to feel in that moment.
Yes.
So I don't not do them. I kind of generally say yes to them because I feel like they take me out of my comfort zone and into a place where I have to face it. And then that just makes me better. So I do enjoy doing panels.
Yeah.
I like sharing my thoughts.
Uh-huh.
But I do have a bit of stage fright.
You do?
I do.
That's interesting. And yet you did television.
I'm fine with television.
You are?
I'm fine with cameras.
It's a live situation?
It's the live situation, and it kind of doesn't even matter how big the crowd is. Like, I will get just as nervous in front of 15 people as I will in front of 1,000.
Interesting.
But it does help when I'm doing something with my hands. So if I'm cooking or doing a demo, it feels more interactive to me.
Right.
It's just being responsible for saying certain things at a certain time that makes me nervous. Yeah.
Did you ever do any acting or anything?
No, I was the kid who grew up in LA and wanted to do the opposite of acting.
Okay.
My sister wanted to be
an
actress.
What? Meaning be in a kitchen?
Yeah, just kind of not be in front
not
of the camera.
Not be in front of people, right.
I went to high school with actresses' kids and... you know, I grew up in LA surrounded by people who wanted to be actors and I just wanted to be different.
Yeah.
So I wanted to be behind the scenes. I wanted to do something creative.
Yeah.
And I didn't really want to be on stage.
Mm-hmm.
But I did find it to be a really kind of fun, creative outlet to do it on TV, I guess. But the cameras really don't affect me like the actual people do, which is interesting because people forget things, right? But cameras don't. So
you mean if you make a mistake in a live situation in front of 200 people, maybe they'll get mentioned at dinner that night and then it's off into the ether. Yeah.
But perhaps walk away and say, like, that was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But they'll forget about it, you know? But when it's recorded on camera, you know, the chances of people forgetting about it ever are slim.
Yes. Well, I mean, that to me is why, like, I do this whole preamble with my guests, which we did before, where I'm like, if something gets awkward, I'll cut it out or whatever. Like, I want people very comfortable.
Right.
And I think probably the best shows have a track record of not completely
you know, taking things out of, I mean, there are shows that do that, right? Take things out of context, pick the lowest common denominator stuff, manipulate things, you know, leave out key moments that led to something.
Not
that does
that.
Happen. Yes. So I think it's right, it's case by case.
Yeah.
It's like a trust thing.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say is for me, like, I love this, what we're doing right now, because from the first time I ever went on radio to promote a book, I'd loved, and it was, I say this only because you mentioned the thing about your hands, right? Like, I did theater in high school and a little bit in college, and, like, I never knew what to do with my hands,
right?
You know, or my arms. I always felt like I needed, like, business, you know, some business, you know? And, but when you're just a talk, you know, when you're just a voice coming through a speaker somewhere,
it
doesn't matter what you're wearing. It doesn't matter. I love that. And then I think there are people who are born. I mean, I'm sure some of your colleagues from the show, you know, I mean, I've seen people who are, I was just on a panel with Brian Mularkey. And I'm like, God, this guy's just like May. He's like
full personality.
The hair is perfect. I'm not making fun of him.
He's ready at any moment.
It was like 9:30 in the morning.
Amazing.
He had the blazer, the nice jeans, the beautiful shoes. The hair was perfect. We got on stage. He was like, every sentence was like perfectly.
Yeah, no, there are certain people who I feel like are really
like born to it.
Born to it. I don't think that's me. I think I'm practiced into it.
Yeah, and you recognize, I'm assuming, the need for it in today's
restaurant world. What, the entertainment factor?
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. So how did you first discover cooking? When you say when you were a kid you wanted to do something different, was it always going to be
it
that?
It was always cooking.
Okay. How did you, what was the first sort of spark? Was it dining out? Was it people who cooked at home? Was it?
Both. My mom, as a kid, my mom cooked dinner 5 nights a week. We sat down for dinner at 6:30 every single night on school nights. And it was a time where there was no TV. There was no music even. It was a time where we caught up on our days and talked about what was going on. And I really, I think, loved the value, appreciated the value that I saw in that.
Yeah.
So from a social aspect, that really intrigued me. And I felt like a lot of it was based around being at the dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of creativity and food, I think I was always, you know, from the moment I figured out how to use Shrinky Dinks. I don't know if you remember Shrinky Dinks.
I know Shrinky Dinks. I don't know. Other people can Google it. I don't know. Can you describe them in less than 25 words?
These
they're weird. They're pretty
clear
weird.
Plastic figurine sort of things that you would draw on with colored pencils, and then you put them in the toaster or the oven.
Yep.
And or toaster oven, which is what we had. And they shrink.
And harden.
So it's just, and harden.
Yeah.
So it's just a tiny little miniature version of what you just drew. And they came to life in a miniature way. So those really, I really loved those. But that was kind of my introduction to using an oven. So I knew how to use the oven because I had been using it for Shrinky Dinks. But really, we had a bunch of fruit trees in our backyard. And I kind of experimented with pancakes first at the age of maybe 6 or 7.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just grew from there. It became me going to the supermarket and finding things that I hadn't seen before to experiment with them. And so it was really from the age of 6 or 7 that I had an interest in food creativity.
Okay.
And then I kind of just decided to go that direction.
Yeah.
By the age of maybe 11 or 12, I knew what I was going to do.
So when you talk about like food creativity, right, did you did you start off with a lot of recipes and cookbooks and whatever, or did you just kind of wing it?
I mean, I started off with Betty Crocker in a book and Julia Child and Jacques Pepin on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So I watched a lot of cooking shows instead of cartoons on Saturday and Sunday mornings. And then I would kind of take what I had seen and go into the kitchen and experiment. That was kind of my weekend activities.
Yeah.
Were just experimenting with what I had seen. And then I think you get to the point where you feel like you know a dish well enough to take some creative liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I was doing that probably by 12 or 13.
Were you good at that kind of thing right away? Like, do you feel like you were making smart, creative decisions when you started to sort of stray from the
most
textbook
of the
version
time, probably not all of the
no,
time.
Not, no,
probably,
no one gets it all the time. Probably, you probably don't get it all the time now.
Yeah, there are probably several people who would disagree that I ever got it right, but I felt like in the moment I was getting it right a lot of the time.
And you enjoyed it.
I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved
it. It's funny, you know, my daughter plays like 4 instruments. My son doesn't anymore, but used to play tennis. And And I remember taking him out once to hit at the U.S. Open grounds, which for anyone listening in New York, 49 weeks a year, that's a public park. You can go hit the, you can go hit on those courts, not in Arthur Ashe Stadium, but you can go hit on like Cordelette.
And I'm a tennis player, so.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, I was a very athletic kid, so the only thing that, that I did sort of outside of the kitchen as a kid was play tennis.
Really? Did you play competitively? I mean, like on a team?
In high school, I was captain of my high school tennis team.
Were you?
Okay. That's my claim to tennis fame. But I also had a moment where I decided that I wanted to be the first female Major League Baseball player.
Really?
And that didn't pan out, nor has it ever for any woman yet. But so
you mean in the you don't mean in a separate league. You mean you wanted to
be on the Dodgers.
Break that? Did you?
That wasn't good
awesome.
Enough, but I wanted it.
Okay.
Yeah.
How far did you go with that?
Nowhere.
It was just a childhood dream.
Yeah.
Anyway, what I was going to say is, I took my son out to the grounds, and some USTA person was like, "Make sure he's just having fun."
Right.
Right. Is that at that age, as a child, right? Because if not, you can get turned off quickly.
Yeah.
So are there any things you, I'm just always intrigued by this, when you started to kind of, you know, take liberties or even maybe start coming up with your own ideas for dishes or something, are there any things that stand out for you that you really particularly, whether or not you thought it came out great, just that you enjoyed, that you thought was fun, that you thought had a sense of humor or wit to it, or that you just thought was particularly creative or particularly you?
Dish-wise?
Yeah, like as a kid.
No.
No?
No. I mean, no. I feel like I was across the board, and I was always more interested in learning new things than I was about repeating things.
Okay.
So,
yeah. Okay. When you decide this is what you're going to do, your parents were down with that?
To an extent.
Like, where was the profession in terms of its regard in society when you made that decision?
It was a profession that very few people made money at.
Yep.
It was a profession that very few women entered who wanted to be in the savory kitchen, at least. The odds were definitely stacked against me, I think, just from the get-go. But my parents were always of the frame of mind that I should do something that makes me happy rather than something that makes me money. And but they had paid a decent amount for my high school education. So I felt like, and I think they felt like, I owed it to them a bit to go to college. And so I went to a year at University of Colorado Boulder and went to business school. And the moment I was able to get out of that first year, I said to them, I just want to be working. And that's actually when I got the job at Phoenix at the Argo.
Okay. So you, I mean, you just mentioned going into the profession as a woman. Do you feel like that factor in Southern California was mitigated? I asked this
back then? We're talking 20-something years ago.
Yeah, but I asked because, like, I remember trying to ask Nancy Silverton about, like, the 70s and her telling me she never had any, she doesn't have horror stories. You know, her whole life was either Northern California or this area.
Right.
Right. And other people have told me they felt, like, you look at, like, Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Fenniger, who had a nightmare of a time even getting jobs in the Midwest.
Right.
You know, and then they come out here and just kind of take off. Like,
first.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering, I'm asking, like, was your experience different than that?
I don't really know, because I think at the time, I was young and naive, and I didn't look at my gender as something that was, that even had the potential of holding me back. I used it to motivate me, and, you know, I was very aware that I was only the only female in every kitchen that I was working in.
Still at that time.
At that time.
And in this area.
In the late 90s.
That's a powerful statement.
Mid to late 90s. I was at least in the savory kitchen. There were always women in pastry.
Yeah, sure.
But in savory, it was like, you want to work this hot grill? Do you know, little girl, how hot this grill gets? And I was like, I'm in. I'm up for it. I can handle it. And I think that people's distrust that I could handle a position motivated me to prove that I could. And I always could. And I always felt so great that I had proved a point afterwards. So, yeah, I mean, there were moments where I felt like potentially people didn't take me seriously because not only was I a woman, but I was really young.
Yeah.
And
I only bring it up because you made that comment in passing about, you know, that that was also a factor in it not probably seeming like the best career move to your family. But, I mean, what's the response? I mean, were you pissed off internally when people said that? And you heard it enough that it was just like, here we go again? Was it just a nuisance? From cooks who would say to you something like, you know, you sure you can handle this hot grill?
You know, not
like,
really.
I would think that would be a really angering thing to hear, especially the more you heard it.
I potentially felt that way. I think I really only gave clout to the people whom I respected in the kitchen, mm-hmm. and whom I knew I wanted to follow their direction.
Yeah.
And I never, fortunately, for that at least first, second year of professional cooking, I had people who really held my hand and wanted to show me the way to properly debone a quail, mm-hmm. and properly make a stock. I hadn't gone to culinary school.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Ken Frank was the one who talked me out of culinary school.
That's so funny.
And I had applied to CIA. I got accepted. There are a certain number of hours, restaurant hours, that you had to work before you went. And so that's why I took that job at the Argyle. And then I never left because he was like, why are you leaving? You're doing what you want to be doing.
Yeah.
And we'll help you along.
Yeah.
So I really had people who had faith, and I think that it was all about work ethic and desire and hunger,
mm-hmm.
that they noticed in who I was as a person.
Mm-hmm. I just have to say, for anyone who's interested, Ken Frank was on the recent episode we did from Chef's Roll in San Diego, and he talks in great detail about his feelings about culinary school.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was like,
feels that way?
You could just go get a job.
Yeah.
He said, and then if you want, you can, the way he put it was, you can spend your parents' money and go do that, but really you could just keep working for people who will teach you.
I think it's about drive and personal motivation.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had so much ambition that I would go home from work and I would read, skill set books, mm-hmm. on how to properly use a knife and how to, you know, what a batonnet was, what a brunoise was. And I felt like because I hadn't gone to school, I was already behind,
mm-hmm.
although I wasn't because I was like 18.
Yeah. Did you practice... Did you practice those things at home?
Would you
buy a bag of potatoes or a bag of onions?
I didn't practice knife skills as much as I did technique, mm-hmm. In terms of like actual cooking, because I felt like I was getting a lot of knife skills, technique practice at work.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my job when I started, I was in pastry first, and then I went to pantry. So I worked the salad station for a while, and that was a lot of, you know, brunoising of vegetables.
Yeah.
So that it was kind of getting that practice on the job.
Yeah. Would we say you were a jock as a kid? Is that a fair statement?
No.
Is that overstating it?
No, I was.
You liked certain sports.
I liked certain sports.
Okay. You were athletic.
I was athletic,
okay.
But I was always kind of a semi-girly girl.
Okay. So did the athletics affect, how did that affect you when you started going into the kitchen? Do you feel like it gave you a leg up?
I think in terms of physical strength, I always made it a point to stay in shape.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is something that is often overlooked in the kitchen for lack of time or lack of motivation, mm-hmm. or energy. And I think that I always realized that the consistency of exercise would really determine how much energy I had at work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always paid mind to that, mm-hmm. and I think that that helped me. I don't know, in a discipline sense, I was always pretty self-disciplined,
mm-hmm.
But I don't know that that had to do with sports.
So when do you start to get a sense of kind of what you were going to be about, like on the plate, like what your, like what Brooke's sort of style was?
I'm still figuring it out.
You still feel like changes, you're figuring it out?
It changes year to year, season to season.
Do you like that?
I do. I love that it's a constantly evolving place that I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
The culinary art world is constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like in order to keep up with that and stay relevant, I need to constantly be learning and changing as well. So, I don't know. I think most people would put me in the category of California cuisine,
mm-hmm.
you know, having worked for Michael and worked for Ken.
Michael McCarty.
And, yeah.
Yeah, I think I told you the other day, other than people who were like at Michael's in like 1979, I don't know. There must be others, but I don't know many people who work for both of those guys.
Right. So my foundation was really working with local product.
Yeah.
And that's the place where I still come from. I have a whole garden at home. Mm-hmm. I come to the farmer's market. And, like, who cares, right? You can order all that stuff at home. But what inspires me in terms of creativity and building a dish is what I look at that's tasting good at that moment. Mm-hmm. So stylistically, I guess that falls into a category. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what that category really means.
Okay. Now, can I ask you, you're married to someone who's in the same business as you are.
Yeah, we're co-chefs and partners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that, I mean, I guess the fact that you took it to that degree is the answer has to be yes. But I generally find that people who are chefs, you know, I think a lot of things that make relationships with chefs difficult kind of just fade away if they're with someone else in the business, and especially if they're with another chef,
right,
in terms of understanding the stresses of the job, in terms of understanding the hours, in terms of understanding all of that.
Yeah, and being able to go home and not have to rehash what you went through that day and not have the other person not understand.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true for you guys?
Yeah, I think it's really, it's also the only way we've ever known each other.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the only way we've ever communicated. We've never not worked together since we've been together.
Mm-hmm.
And I also feel like there have been moments in our almost 12-year marriage where the restaurants are what held us together, logistically. But
how do you mean? Can I? I don't want to get more personal than you want. But how do you mean
that? That you know, marriages go through hard times, great times, and I think sometimes people have the option to just walk away.
Mm-hmm.
And being someone's business partner and being so intertwined in each other's lives, I think. Pushes you to a point where you're forced to work things out.
Mm-hmm.
And not only for your own sake and our child's sake, but for the sake of over 100 employees.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that we don't take our relationship lightly. And just like any married couple, we go through ups and downs.
Yeah.
But I call it restaurant glue. And I think it's honestly the strongest glue that exists.
This makes total sense to me. You know, I have very good... David Waltuck, who was one half of Chanterelle Restaurant, which had an almost 30-year run. You know, he and his wife, Karen, they're still together. Mm. They have two kids. It was very difficult when their kids were young because one of them would usually run home before dinner service and... Mm-hmm.
That's
them,
what you trade off.
You know, and then, yeah, and then come back.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. When our son was much younger, we took turns. One of us would go home and put him to bed. We never wanted our child to be raised by someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Nor did we financially have that option.
Yeah.
So we would take turns going home, and we would have an individual date night with our child every other night.
And, that's great.
We had the luxury of doing that and being such a part of our child's upbringing that... I feel like that was really valuable.
Uh-huh. Can I ask, he's fifth grade?
He's in fifth grade, yeah.
Is he at all interested or at least enjoy what you guys do?
He's like interested. The world that you're in? He enjoys it. I don't know that he has that passion that I had at his age, but I think most people don't.
No, but I mean, he enjoys like going to restaurants with you guys. And
he loves fancy restaurants.
Uh-huh.
He loves being in a... He's kind of a picky eater, but when he's put into a position where it would be rude to turn something down, he always tries it. And I think he likes to be pushed, and so he does like to dine out. He also loves to kind of help me out in the kitchen at home. We do a project once a week where a kitchen project once a week where we'll make something so that he can see the whole process of something and he gets to choose what it is.
Oh, that's great.
So he's exposed to it. And like I said, if I had been exposed like he was, I would have reacted differently at his age than he does. He could kind of take it or leave it.
Yeah.
But again, he's 11 years old.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
Maybe he'll run with it. Maybe he won't.
Yeah. I mean, my experience, I have two 14-year-olds, is that they just bounce around from stuff to stuff.
Yeah.
One of my kids takes their pursuits more seriously, but still usually moves on at some point.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, he plays tennis, he plays piano. Maybe tomorrow he won't.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Exactly. So how are you? I'm just curious because I feel like I've been coming out here a bunch the last
5-6 years, I feel like the city is palpably, from a culinary standpoint, from a restaurant standpoint, palpably changing. It feels
1,000% from what it was when I first started.
Well, that for sure, but universe. Even in the last 10 years, I feel like, I'm just wondering from within the industry and as someone who's been here, what strikes you, if that's not too broad a question? I mean, it doesn't feel that different here at this. I mean, this market, to me anyway, still feels special.
Than it did here in LA
a while back.
No, I think the market has really kind of maintained the same feel.
Yeah.
And I think the West Side has kind of almost maintained the same
feel. That's an interesting distinction.
I think that downtown and Koreatown and the East Side has really flourished.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are certain areas, and a lot of that I think is dictated on rent and legalities and licenses and stuff. But we've kind of chosen to be in these pocket areas that are more neighborhood oriented, which has been great for us. We kind of love getting to know our communities.
Yep.
And, but now I think as a whole, Los Angeles has really become this incredibly inspiring food mecca.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Do you, it's interesting to me that you're saying this in all positive terms, because a lot of people I know are starting to really feel the competitive
squeeze. Labor, I think, is an issue, which I get. Labor's always been an issue for us because we're in these sort of beach towns that are, you know, the last bus leaves at 9. And, and we have logistical issues with labor. But I think there is a labor shortage. Mm-hmm. And not that there is a shortage of hands. Because I think that because of what TV has done the last 10 years, there are a lot of aspiring chefs.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there are a limited number of qualified hands who understand that you can't start at the top. So labor, I think, is difficult from that perspective. I don't know. I think, to me, being in a city where food is looked at seriously outweighs the negatives.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't trying to be pessimistic.
No, I mean, I could go a different direction, but I'm going to choose not to. I just had a whole conversation with Jen Harris from the LA Times yesterday about the trials and tribulations of running a restaurant in Los Angeles, and there are a lot, and I went negative yesterday, so I'm going to stay positive
today.
This
is the counterbalance. Right. Can you just talk to me for a minute about what it's like co-chefing? It's something that's so fascinating to me. Because I think people who do, it's not as uncommon as it used to be.
Right.
And I think when it is done well, there is a seamlessness about it. You know, the food doesn't feel like it's done by.
No, well, we've also cooked together since we were 22 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So we know each other's brains, each other's creative brains in and out. And we kind of know where to tread lightly and where to be objective, and we bounce ideas off of each other. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I don't want to hear his opinion. Sometimes I really value his opinion, and I think vice versa.
You've worked out a whole sort of set of language and cues and things
and
around that?
Not in a very methodical way, just in a very natural, organic way. I think we just know each other so well that we know where we complement each other, and we know when to leave each other alone.
Yeah.
So, you know, I in a million years would never... I say that right now, but who knows how I would feel at another moment. But I don't see myself partnering at this stage in my career.
Sure.
I don't see myself partnering with someone else that I don't know as well.
Do you feel like by virtue of starting to do this, you know, so young, that your sort of individual styles honed it around, you know, along a similar track?
Probably.
Did that almost become like the same track?
Yeah, I mean, stylistically, I think we learned together.
Yeah,
and now probably more I than he has the opportunity or have the opportunity to go to other cities and work with other chefs and see what other people are doing. So creatively, I think I've probably taken the reins a little bit more in the last couple of years, only by fact of travels and being able to see more than he has. Yeah. You know, he's, when I'm in Denver or New York or Montana or whatever, oftentimes he's home mm-hmm. taking care of business at the mm-hmm. restaurants and watching our son.
Yeah.
Which is just as valuable.
In, oh, sure.
You know, to me. So, you know, we've adjusted over the years and changed our roles, mm-hmm. but I think it was out of necessity and we both understood that necessity.
Yeah. So can you speak for 1 minute, just because you've done it? I've had a lot of people on the show who've done it, the whole Top Chef thing, mm-hmm. chapter in your
thing.
Life thing. Yeah, well, it is its own thing.
Yeah.
But I think that show in particular, I think I first said it when I had Richard Blaze, who was there yesterday, but mm-hmm. Richard Blaze was on this show, my first season. And like I'm not just saying it. I think of the competition shows, I think that is actually a show that... like, you know, quote unquote, real chefs tend to win that show. And I remember Richard said to me, it's not just win, like real chefs, the top five or six, you know, the five or six last people to still be in the mix are right. all generally really good people, you know, really good talent.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that show is distinct from that standpoint.
And I think it's also one of those shows that's not overproduced. You know, mm-hmm. they're not putting words in anybody's mouths. All of those words are spoken.
Yeah.
And, you know, there might be, I always say they can't create a personality for you.
Yes.
That personality exists. They yeah. might highlight certain aspects of it.
Yes.
But
you
I
mean
think
through editing.
Through editing, yeah. But I think
that's part of, I mean, that's
it's
legit.
Part of making it entertaining.
That's legitimate.
And, but I don't think they manipulate you for entertainment value. I think they're really sort of true to keeping it about the food and keeping yeah. it about the actual talent. And I think that they've garnished this sort of respect from chefs to understand that they're not going onto this show for a publicity stunt mm-hmm. and that you need to be a certain caliber to be able to compete. And you're not going to do it if you know that you don't have that in your wheelhouse.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not to say there aren't people who make it through casting that shouldn't be there, but they generally get eliminated.
Well, I just had a thought for the first time, which is, I mean, to me, it points out one of the weird things about any cooking company. The fact that people get what they get out of the show as competitors mm-hmm. has always been kind of funny to me because the audience can't taste the food.
Right.
Like, you actually don't know. You're taking, like, Tom and Padma and whoever else's word for whether it's good or not, right? But you haven't tasted it, which is kind of funny.
Right.
But those shows, unlike, say, the singing shows, there is no audience call-in. So you right. can't kind of take over on a personality because somebody like Tom...
Not until it's time to vote for fan favorite, right?
That, yes, yes. But I mean...
Yeah, no.
No, but I mean...
Competition-wise, yeah.
Competition-wise, you know, and Tom, I know, I interviewed Tom this January, and he was adamant that when he first came in, it was like... You know, one of his conditions was, you know, we pick the winners.
Yeah, to a almost frustrating extent on occasion, in the sense that, like, I felt like I had performed so strongly up until a certain challenge,
yeah.
and then there was one challenge that I fumbled on, and it was like, sorry, you're judged based on this dish.
Yeah,
and it's frustrating, but also keeps you on your toes and,
yeah.
and keeps you. You know, keeps you in fear, which is something you kind of need
yes.
on that show.
Yeah.
If you know, if you're not scared, if you're not nervous, it means you don't care enough.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there is sort of a, not to get romantic, I mean, there's sort of a poetic justice to this notion that one bad service can take you down, right?
Yeah.
Because I mean, that could happen in real life.
Serve one bad meal to a critic and
yeah.
you're done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It also ties back to tennis, right? You have a...
One bad shot.
You can, or a bad match in the semis, and the first five matches of the tournament don't matter.
I think it's that way probably with a lot of things.
All right. Well, you probably need to get back to the market. It was great to meet you.
You too.
Thanks for making time for this.
Nice
thanks
to put
for...
a face to the name on the book.
Oh, thank you. Yes, and we talked earlier. You actually, well, accidentally probably you're going to end up buying it three different ways.
You know, it's just for lack of having time to read that I haven't gotten through it, but that's why I tried to download the audio.
You tried to get the audio, you accidentally bought the ebook.
Yeah. Well, it happens, but
so I appreciate your embarrassing degree of support for the book. All right.
Thank you.
Enjoy the week. Thanks.
You too.
And that's our show for this week. Huge thanks to the LA Chef Conference for having us, to Brad Metzger and his team for hosting us, to the Viceroy Hotel for putting me up, to our guests, Meredith Bell, Laura Avery, Michael Cimarusti, Della Gossett, Brooke Williamson, and Brad Metzger, who doubled as host and guest, to Jeet Paul, our engineer. Jeet, thank you for bearing with my schedule this week and editing this show on a Thursday instead of a Tuesday. I'm 2 days late, and you were very gracious about it. To the rest of the team at Heritage, thank you very much for all your support. As always, to Caitlin for joining me for the intros, and to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening. If you feel like it, throw us a rating or a review on iTunes. It really does help people find the show, and we would be forever grateful. That's it for this week. See you back here next week with a new episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebrations happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends. And please, join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.